We're going to start the meeting. The secretary will be coming in a little late, so we'll start. Maybe we can start by saying the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag.
The Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, the first item on the agenda is a presentation. I'm going to ask Charlie Kilpatrick to present for me. The links on your computer are not working, so do you have it? Does everyone have that up?
No, I'll show you the first one.
Okay. I'll be there.
The link for this particular presentation, and I believe one other presentation, is not working. The remaining link should work. Does everyone have a copy of the presentation?
All right, we ready?
So,
good morning, Commissioner, members of the board.
Good morning.
I'm here today to make a presentation to you that you should have received via mail in advance. We also provided this presentation to all the General Assembly members along with a cover letter that was sent out about a week ago. And what this does is it highlights some of the things that we are doing and some things that we are continuing to move forward with within the department. A lot of this follows the business plan, which you have seen before. And Frank, a lot of this is our highlights of some of our initiatives. I mean, first and foremost, we've endured a significant amount of change over the last several years with changes in staffing, with changes in processes, and changes in how we conduct our business. But we continue to make tremendous progress in moving things forward. We can't simply stop and retool. Our operation is a 24/7 operation, building and maintaining a significant road system, the third largest in the country. We're a more focused agency than we have been in the past number of years. We're really focusing on getting back to the basics of building and maintaining our road system. That is our core business. That's what we're about. We've had many successes, but we need to continue to stabilize some of our areas and continue to grow as we move forward. It's very important for you to understand that we do have a plan, and we are working through that plan. This talks to the personnel levels of the department and how the dramatic changes that have occurred over the last several years. You can see, I won't go through in detail this, but today we are at about 7,000 employees. In 2008, we were at 8,500 almost. And some historical background, when I left the department around 2004, we were over 10,000 employees. So again, you can see a significant change in the amount of personnel, and that really drives the way we conduct our business. So talking about the progress we've made and our focus and really getting back to the basics of building and operating our road system, you're aware of the audit findings, the audit regarding the Public-Private Transportation Act, the audit regarding our operations and maintenance, the audit regarding research, and the audit regarding our programming and planning functions. And those created a significant number of audit findings that we continue to manage and work through and address. We also have developed a business plan, which you have copies of, that gives a roadmap of how we're going to implement a number of these improvements and changes as we move forward. Number of changes in leadership. Frankly, me being one, as appointed by the governor as a chief deputy commissioner, my primary role has been in two areas, in field operations of 9 construction districts, as well as the public-private transportation projects. We eliminated the chief of research and technology. We created a new chief of administration that consolidated a number of functions. That's Grinley Johnson. We hired a chief financial officer. That's John Lawson, splitting that responsibility out from chief of planning and programming, who is Rita Buescher. During this time, we've also hired three new district administrators. One of them was a transfer, being Garrett Moore from Stanton to Northern Virginia. The governor also appointed Tony Kinn as the director of the P3 office. We've got a new director of our research center in Charlottesville. We have eight new division administrators, including those, as I've talked from the beginning, two of those core business functions of the state construction engineer and the state maintenance engineer. We've also hired four new district maintenance managers. Those are used to be called assistant district administrators. That's the number two person in that district for maintenance. We've also hired 19 additional staff focused on developing and delivering projects, as well as hired a number of staff restoring some of our emergency services that are a critical part of our business. One of the first business goals was to establish a seamless multimodal system that moves people and freight. And within those goals are some initiatives to further move forward our construction program. One of those being to increase the number of PE starts. Right now we have about 11% of our funding going towards preliminary engineering starts. What that's doing is rebuilding our shelf of projects and getting projects into the pipeline, ready to go as construction dollars become available. We advertised $1.2 billion in projects between July and December of 2010. And in 2011, we advertised $1.8 billion in projects, including almost $400 million in design build and over $1.3 billion in the second half of this past calendar year. That is one of the largest construction advertisements in recent memory in VDOT. We've also reestablished the project delivery meetings. We call them the 24-month ad meetings, and that is a focused effort to ensure that projects, as they approach construction, are on track, are on time, are on budget. You're aware of some of the major projects that we've talked about and have come before you over the past year, including the downtown Midtown Tunnel, Route 460, the I-95 Hot Lanes Project, the Coalfields Expressway, and the Route 58 Project. We've also, through one of the audit findings regarding planning and programming, increased our outreach to our MPOs, including meetings throughout the Commonwealth we held in the fall, and many of you attended those meetings, as well as working with our stakeholder groups on some local issues, including subdivision street requirements, access management, and the like. In the area of the sustainable and stable financial support, as you're aware, we are issuing CPR bonds. We issued $600 million in May of 2011, and we're scheduled to issue another $600 million in May of 2012. In addition, we anticipate issuing $350 million in Garvey bonds in February. That money is largely to go to the Downtown Midtown Tunnel project. We've also increased the revenue sharing program significantly. The CTB approved $103 million for FY12 program, and the anticipated budget amount of $150 million for the FY13 program. And again, this is a great example of us being able to double our money, because local governments are putting in an additional $150 million into that program. We've developed and implemented guidelines and procedures for the Infrastructure Bank, capitalizing it with almost $300 million. And today you will see the first application in that program. We're very excited about the early success of that program and look forward to it being a sustainable revenue stream for us for projects. The governor's transportation package, approved last year by the General Assembly and signed by the governor, included a significant influx of projects, and this just gives some statistics on some of the projects that we have completed, moved, are underway in engineering and construction, and those expected to be under construction this year, or excuse me, within the next 3 years, as well as those P3 projects that we talked about earlier. Also in the area of innovative technology, environmental protection, and system management, this past December, we launched the new financial system for VDOT called Cardinal. And what that system is accounts payable, accounts receivable. It is our time entry. It is our lead system. This is a major change in the way we manage our finances, our day-to-day finances within the department, and will become the Commonwealth system in approximately 2 years. So we are we were entrusted with creating and launching this system for the Commonwealth, and we're very proud of that. We are working through the bugs as we go, and bills are being paid every day, again, as we move forward. In addition, some new technologies, including quiet pavement and in-place recycling, have been done. The in-place recycling project on 81 was a very successful project for us. Look for opportunities in the future. In the area of quiet pavement technology, we found some immediate benefits on those projects, both with asphalt and with concrete pavement, and we've had several projects throughout Virginia. We're exploring private sector sponsorship of various programs. Most recently, the 511 contract was awarded, and that is what we call traffic video and data contract. That will recreate the 511 website and system, and it's also an opportunity for revenue as they can market the video feeds that we have. In addition, the rest areas have been reopened, the ones that were closed, and now operate with revenue opportunities also, including some advertisement, or excuse me, sponsorship. We're actively managing our highway systems. The I-66 active traffic management system is that request for proposals is underway. That will be the first in Virginia where we'll be able to actively manage traffic lanes, traffic speeds, and provide real-time data. We're also piloting a snowplow GPS system in Northern Virginia. This is a exciting opportunity where the public will be able to better see our snow operations. Our intention is to expand that throughout the Commonwealth so people will be able to see real-time our snow removal efforts throughout the Commonwealth. Maintaining a strong customer focus. When we turned on the Customer Service Center about 2 years ago almost now, frankly, we began on a bit of a shoestring, and we've done a number of improvements to that system to provide a better experience to those that are calling into our call centers and to give them good information and to be able to respond quickly to work order requests. I mentioned earlier the new 511 system that the contract has been let, and they're in development now, that new website and better video feeds. Another important aspect is that we've gone back and re-looked at the role of the residency offices. Under the blueprint, those offices largely became maintenance headquarters, and we recognize now that we have a significant gap between our local governments and our citizens and the services that we provide, and we're looking very carefully at reinforcing the residency offices and to provide a better liaison and contact point with local government and our local citizens. I think that is a major step towards improving relationships in the counties and towns throughout Virginia. We also, as part of an update and a new procurement of our operation centers, are expanding our safety service patrol programs, adding those back to the 95 corridor as well as downtown Richmond, extensions in Hampton Roads, Charlottesville, as well as the 81 corridor. I mentioned earlier, real-time travel times. As part of the 66 project, we have already initiated some travel time messaging on 66 and 95, and we're looking to expand that into the Hampton Roads area by the summer of this year. In the area of improving safety, we're developing and implementing a new strategic highway safety plan, and you can see that we expect that to be completed in 2012 this year, as well as a significant influx towards our HSIP, our Highway Safety Improvement Plan, investing in pavement markers, pavement markings, and other safety features on our roadways. You can see there, in putting our money to work, we've reallocated about $42 million off of inactive projects so that we could put that money to work. In developing and maintaining a strong and stable workforce, again, post-blueprint, this has been a challenge with a number of people displaced and moved throughout the department, and rebuilding the core of our organization. Many of these things are internal to the department, including a reinstituting the leadership conference, the state truck rodeo, and that's an opportunity for those who may not know, for our equipment operators to showcase their skills. It's a great sense of pride around the Commonwealth for those folks to participate in that event and show off their incredible equipment operation skills. We're conducting a number of workshops, including equipment management, maintenance management, and a number of other areas. The commissioner reinstated the Commissioner's Award for Excellence, and this is an opportunity to acknowledge individuals and groups for their outstanding performance. The Core Development Program is a program where we bring college graduates into the department and train them in a number of fields through a structured program. And also the Inspector Trainee Program, similarly, to bring new construction inspectors in and train them in an organized way so that they can manage our construction projects in the future. We're also working as part of last year's legislation to transition the Inspector General's office from VDOT to the State Inspector General, Office of the State Inspector General. In the focus on maintenance, we've doubled our paving program last year from $200 million to almost $400 million in paving, and I hope you've seen the results of that. We've provided the Commonwealth Transportation Board with monthly progress reports on where we are on maintenance spending and on other funds. And in the area of improving the condition of our roadways, you can see that we expect to meet our paving target on the interstate system by 2012 and 2013 on the primary, and we also anticipate meeting our bridge target in June of 2012. Mm-hmm. That is a significant achievement and improvement in the quality of our road system. I won't spend a lot of time on this graphic. The commissioner has shown this to you a number of times, and what it really talks about is our unspent balances. Last year, our unspent balance, although it was almost $500 million, we had contract obligations of $626 million. We are trying to drive that, we'll call it purple line, down even further, in anticipating that will be less than $200 million this year and continue to drop. And that's our unspent balance at the end of the fiscal year. This goes to spending the money that has been entrusted to us in the years that we get it, and not allowing it to build up unnecessarily. This is in the area of structures, and again, as I mentioned, we expect to meet the statewide target in early next fiscal year. This is our paving target, and again, we've made significant progress in this area. I won't spend a lot of time on it, but as you can see, we expect to meet target this year on interstate and next year on primary, and we are putting some additional emphasis on our secondary system that has been suffering. So this is one of our primary missions, and that is in the area of emergency response. As you know, this has been a bit of a busy year with an earthquake and a hurricane and a tropical storm, along with the the more common events that occur, whether it's an accident or a road washout or a pipe collapse. But this is just some pictures of some of the things that our folks do every day, 24/7. On project delivery, I talked earlier about the levels of contract award, and again, I can't say enough times that the volume of contracts that we put out this year, over $1.8 billion, I mean, it's a huge, huge number. We also have implemented some risk-based project development where we are allowing district offices approvals and moving projects forward with less oversight from the central office. In the area of obligating our federal dollars, we obligated 100% of our federal dollars, and in FY 11, we received an additional $32 million from the federal government. In FY 12, we received $50 million in additional funds. Those funds were largely put this past year on additional paving projects throughout the Commonwealth where we could put that money to work immediately. Those contracts have been let, and we are in the process of receiving bids on those contracts. So, again, we didn't let that money just sit. We put it to work immediately. We've eliminated the federal revenue reserve, and that has freed up a significant amount of money to plow back into the program. And we've revised our cash and funding policies, again, to better leverage our funds and put that money to work. This graph just shows a trend of how we are reducing our overhead costs and, again, focusing more of our attention towards delivering of projects. So focusing on the organizational efficiencies, again, I mentioned the residencies. The commissioner and I and others are spending a significant amount of time re-looking at that and looking at some opportunities to rebuild and reinforce that area. I talked about the delegated authority on our lower risk projects. We're shoring up some key areas, including our monitoring of our TAMs, which are our interstate maintenance contracts, as well as environmental monitoring. And we are also encouraging and sponsoring a number of meetings between district personnel and industry representatives. We find those are great opportunities to resolve issues before they boil up into greater controversy. We've achieved targeted staffing levels in central office, as well as targeted division levels, and we're actively working to streamline business processes in programming, procurement, human resources, local agreements, and financial transactions. And we're also looking at performance metrics, both with the executive level and the Division Administrators Council, holding them accountable for delivering their responsibilities. So moving forward, we're stabilizing our staffing level and solidifying and strengthening our organizational structure. We're realigning our business processes to a new organizational structure. And again, when you go from over 10,000 people to around 7,000, you just can't do things the same way that you used to. We're a very, very different organization than we were. Again, my background in 2004. We're capitalizing on some opportunities to operate more effectively and more efficiently. And we're focusing on our core resources, on our core functions, to get back to doing the basics very well. I mean, that's the core of our business, construction and maintenance, and we need to do it well every day. We need to continue to foster and build a climate of innovation and problem solving. The public expects us to solve problems. The public does not expect us to write policies and procedures. They expect us to solve problems, and that's one of the cores of our business. We're going to continue to expand business opportunities and with partnerships and with private industry. Again, with less people, it's an absolute necessity. We are not doing things ourselves anymore. We are relying much more on our contract partners and other partners to deliver services. And also to improve the working environment for our staff, whether it's a morale or development opportunities and training opportunities, to really reinforce the importance of those 7,000 employees.
Mr. Chairman, Yes.
Is that a new target, 7,000? Because it wasn't our target 75?
No, sir. I'm using the number 7,000. Our authorized strength is 7,500. Actually, 7,499. Live bodies on board, and I won't go into the story of the one, but the live bodies on hand today is 7,000. And we are continuing, as part of our initiatives, to lift up that number to get us up to 7,500, but we are 500 short of our authorized mail now. If you can imagine, as we recruit people, people retire, people leave, we've had a number of promotions as we've created vacancies, so there's a lot of internal movement. But no, sir, the 7,500 is our authorized mail.
Just to follow up to Mr. King's question, is there any particular area where we're short of those 500? Are you concentrating on a particular area, or is it spread out?
Well, one of the a comment I'd made earlier in the presentation, one area that we recognize the need to rebuild and build a pool going forward is in construction inspection, where we reduce that number significantly. We rely significantly on consultant inspectors throughout Virginia, and they do a great job for us. But we believe we still need to maintain a core of state inspectors that can manage projects and that can, frankly, grow to the higher levels in the construction area, become construction managers, become the folks that handle our claims and other construction-related things. We've got to rebuild the bench. So that's one example. Another area we're focusing on is in project management. Again, we design things. We don't design projects the way we used to. We don't have large drafting staffs. We don't have large design staff. What we have is a significant amount of professional services contracts to design these projects, and we need quality project managers. So that's another area we are focused on. I would say that throughout that 500 is spread to a number of areas. But again, to the commissioner, has been really wanting to focus some attention on some core business areas. And we see the need for two things, immediate needs and as well as our future.
Thank you.
Mr. Miller.
So that you don't get misinterpreted, help me with something. Whenever you hear somebody in the government say, we've got 7,000 people for live bodies, I was going to ask you where the dead bodies are. You got 7,000, and we're authorized for 7,500 or 7,499. So we're trying to get there. You know, the private sector person would say, I don't care what you're authorized. How many do you need? You know, if you don't need 7,499. So what I'm really trying to get at is sort of Aubrey's turn on Aubrey's question. If you're 500 short right now, what problems is that creating, and when do you expect to sort of get to 7,500 so those problems that are being created by lack of staff goes away?
Well, you know, at the very ground level, when that position is vacant, these positions are all positions that are assigned to a particular unit and have a particular job. So when that person isn't there, very simply, someone else is having to do that job, or you're doing less of it. That's kind of the very simple answer of what happens. So these are, again, it's not a pool of positions that we haven't sprinkled around yet. These are all assigned to particular areas. And over the last, since the commissioner was appointed, has spent a lot of time looking at, okay, where do these positions need to go? We've made a number of changes. We have eliminated positions that we didn't feel were as critical and refocused the attention towards some of our core business areas. Excuse me. So that's what we've been working on, to get the people, get the people in the right chair, not just in a chair, because that doesn't help you. It's to put people into the right chairs, into the right trucks, and the right places to deliver our services, again, with a very different model than we had in the past. We're not going out and hiring drafts people. We're hiring project managers. We're not hiring to the extent that we used to, inspectors. I made a comment earlier, we are bringing inspectors back because we've got to have a core pool. but we're not going to a wholesale. We're going to have 500 inspectors at DDOT that are state employees now. We're strategically putting people in the places that they need to be.
So when do you expect you'll get to where the extremis is relieved some?
To give you an exact answer, that a lot of it's frankly driven by just our ability to bring people on. But we're driving to have this done within, again, I'd venture to say within the next 12 months to be able to drive to that number. The challenge, again, is as we hire people and as the economy improves, there are other job opportunities for folks. It's maybe simply a retirement. It may be, again, it's a career change. And as you all know, many of you are in business, that the years of 40-year, 50-year, 30-year employees, there are going to be less and less employees that stay with one company for that length of time. And so it's a constant, we're competing with the private industry.
Sure.
We're competing with other governments.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, following on this, you mentioned that one of the areas that you're going to be looking at is design. It's no, I don't mean this as any reflection on the people that are currently there, but do we need a large design staff in-house when there's an awful lot of innovation in the private sector that we may be precluding in the early stages? In other words, we may be keeping that from getting in our early design because we're not going out looking for it. And so I guess that's the question. Do we really need to build it up? Do we need to look at how we're doing design and how we might be more efficient in doing that?
We are not building our design staff. What I mean by that, technicians, CAD operators, used to call them draftsmen, that are doing hydraulics engineers that are doing that level of design. We do very little in-house design. We have the districts have in most cases a small design team that can pick up a small project here or there or a fill-in, that type of thing. And even here in the central office where we used to have large design teams, we just don't have that anymore. What those folks are doing, we have a lot more licensed engineers than we used to. We have a lot more project managers than we used to. And what those people are doing is they are managing a consultant contract that we say to a consultant, we need you to design this project, these bridges, these culverts, and give us a finished product. That's a significant change. Again, if I go back 10 years ago, we were doing a lot of our design work in-house in many of the districts. Today, we do almost no in-house design work. And whether that's in road design or bridge design or in traffic engineering design, very little of that work is done in-house.
Okay, thank you.
Let me pick up the speed a little bit here. I know we have a full schedule, but I wanted to run through the last few slides here. Yeah, we talked about ideas to consider moving forward, some opportunities to charge for use of the right-of-way, advertising and the like, and we're continuing to explore those options, working with local government to raise additional revenue and oversee local projects. We've had some stumbles, but we've also had some great success stories, and you're going to hear about one later on this morning as part of the VTIP presentation. Allow VDOT to employ innovative measures to attract and retain quality employees. And again, looking at how do we better get those employees to workforce and how do we retain them and establish some programs that we can better compete with the private sector. Some streamlining in some of our real estate land issues, and also for us to be able to operate independent of EVA. EVA is a statewide program regarding procurement transactions, and we pay a significant amount towards that as well as the contracting industry, and hoping again to have an opportunity. We think that we can operate outside of that program more effectively and more efficiently. So finally, as I said at the beginning, we've had a lot of change, but we continue to make tremendous progress, and you can see that in the numbers, in the quality of our pavements, and in the number of projects we're putting out. We are becoming a more focused agency, getting back to the basics of maintenance and construction. At the end of the day, that's what the public expects. And we've had many successes, but we've got to continue to build on that in order to for us to move forward and continue to be the problem solvers that the public expects us. And as the commissioner has said, in many cases, we have a plan and we're working this plan. So thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Charlie.
I will, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Mr. Richards.
Two quick points on personnel. At our last meeting in 2011, we ran out of time, and I just didn't have time to publicly thank you and your staff for all the hard work you did in 2011, and I wanted to publicly do that and thank you all. The second is we had talked before about maybe trying to see if we could work in some of our returning veterans from Virginia to see if we could maybe have some kind of a program to see if we could hire them if we had some appropriate slots, maybe through a job fair or something. If we could try to reach out to our returning veterans who may be able to serve us, that's something I hope you all could look into. Some of them need work, and they may be very well qualified.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, and we'll definitely do that. And maybe we can put on the agenda the Wounded Veterans Program. So we do have a Wounded Veterans Program.
Well, that's great.
I also wanted to give this presentation to the board today because I'm going to give a similar presentation to Senate Transportation tomorrow. I believe it's around 2 o'clock. And we just wanted to share with them some of the accomplishments that we're doing in transportation. Just letting them know that the funding that they approved last year, that we are aggressively using it. And if they choose to give us additional funds, we'll be able to use it as well. So we are going to meet with the Senate Transportation tomorrow, and we've sent this presentation to all the General Assembly members, and we'll probably be scheduling other presentations throughout the General Assembly.
Thank you.
Thank you, Charlie. So the next item is freight rail, Mr. Mark Hecker from Norfolk Southern. Welcome.
Thank you. Just give me a minute. I'll get this up, and we get started. Okay.
We think we're ready.
Okay. Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure for us at Norfolk Southern to meet with you, share what's going on in Virginia with our railroad and with our different projects. We have a very good partnership with Virginia and a lot of good stuff to talk about. I know we are pressed for time, so just going to outline what we'll go over. Generally, our presence in Virginia, what we have going on, where our routes run. We'll give you an update on Heartland Corridor, which opened up in October 2010. And go over Crescent, talk about the terminals, main line, and then finally close up with the Norfolk passenger train. And we're working with DRPT on that, so I know they're going to cover that topic as well. So briefly, if you're not familiar with the Norfolk Southern system, we're 21,000 miles, 22 states, East Coast Railroad. What we have going on in Virginia is a major part of our operation. We have our headquarters, of course, in Norfolk, Virginia. We have major terminals, Lamberts Point, Roanoke, Lynchburg, also major shops in Roanoke, and have some of our major main lines, particularly our coal conveyor going from West Virginia, Western Virginia, over to Lamberts Point. It's also an intersection of two of the most of our very important corridors that we have for intermodal traffic. There's four of them that we have. There's the Meridian Speedway, Pan Am Southern, Heartland Corridor, and Crescent Corridor. The two that obviously intersect in Virginia, Heartland and Crescent. We'll go through those momentarily. So let's start with Heartland. This was really a first of its kind for the United States, a real model for public-private partnerships involving private industry, private company like Norfolk Southern, and several states and other public entities. We opened this in September 2010. It was a substantial engineering project where we opened up tunnels to allow double-stack containers to get through a route that had previously been prohibited to just single-stack traffic. It was a substantial effort, required clearances going through 28 tunnels, other overhead obstructions. What this does for us in terms of traffic, it saves about 200 miles and a day in terms of travel time. These pictures give you an idea of some of the work that was done in various tunnels across that route. And this is a good map diagram to show what the difference is. On the left-hand side, you can see what the old route looked like and where we could run trains, but we could only run single stack. And on the right-hand side, you can see the Heartland Corridor, where we, again, made that cut of 200 miles and now have a day better running time for intermodal traffic. This positions us very well to serve the Port of Norfolk, particularly as the widening of the Panama Canal comes open in 2014. And this gives us a very good position to bring that traffic from the East Coast into the Midwest and up to places like New York City. What we've seen so far as of our third quarter earnings report is 139% year-over-year growth for Heartland. Now, keep in mind, we are moving some existing traffic that we had on other routes that we've moved to that, so it's not purely new traffic. In terms of organic growth, we saw a 13% increase. So it's looking very favorable, particularly when you consider where we're at with the overall economy right now. Moving on to Crescent, again, I think a lot of you are familiar with this one. We have several projects going on with Virginia and Crescent Corridor. This is a 2,500-mile route, particularly for intermodal trains, focuses on domestic freight. And what we're trying to do here is get as much truck traffic onto the railroad as possible. So we're scheduling against the kinds of needs that truckers have. We see them as our partners. Obviously, we need them to deliver the last mile. And this is an opportunity where we're looking at ongoing challenges that are going on with the trucking industry. We've got the driver shortages, you've got congestion, and you always have the variability of fuel prices. And those factors we don't see going away anytime soon, and we think that's a really good basis for further investment in Crescent. The basic scope of the project for Crescent, we're building new terminals, we're investing in existing ones, expanding them, we're increasing the speeds of our main lines, we're adding passing tracks where we don't have them, trying to eliminate choke points, and the total cost roughly is about $2.5 billion, and we're looking at that as a long-term investment, so you're looking at about 10 years out where we would expect to have to spend that level of money. This is a good view of Crescent. What I've done, I know that there have been a lot of presentations out there on Crescent. I've simplified this a bit to show you what we have going on right now and not look at the stuff that's coming in future years. Briefly, the red dots are terminals that we expect to open in 2012. And the three green dots are the three active Virginia projects we have going on right now. So let's start with the terminals. One of the ones that we got some Tiger money from was the Memphis-Rossville terminal. This is a terminal that is on our main line. It's just east of Memphis. You can see the highlight on the screen there. Essentially, that's our main line following that purple, and this is near routes 57 and 72, so good highway access, good position to bring in Midwest traffic and have that go up the Crescent Corridor. This is a view of what the construction site looks like right now. We are moving a lot of dirt. This is a 500-acre site. If you look at those dots that are in the middle, our chief engineer, Dooley, pointed out that some of the biggest equipment that Caterpillar makes today, just to give you an idea of the scale of this facility. This is well under construction. Again, you're looking at the south end of the terminal, that loop you see at the bottom. is a turning loop for trains. We'll have pad tracks. We'll have loading facilities, and this will also connect up on the north side with the Y to our main line. Looking at Birmingham, Alabama, again, another critical piece of funneling traffic through the Crescent Corridor. This was also given some funding from the Tiger program at the federal level. This one's a little bit different configuration. This one's parallel to our main line as opposed to perpendicular. This allows the trains to get off the main line, prevent any congestion issues. And again, same kind of facility. You've got parking for trucks, parking for chassis, and loading facilities in Birmingham. And we're also moving dirt there. This gives you an overview. This is slightly smaller in terms of acreage, about 300 acres, but still a pretty substantial amount of dirt that we are moving. Again, we expect both of these to open in 2012 and be great conduits to bring traffic up the Crescent Corridor through Virginia and up to the northeast. This is the other one, moving up north, Greencastle, Pennsylvania. I don't have quite as a dramatic a shot because this is a lot harder work. We have to actually blast stone to get through this. This is a little bit smaller in terms of acreage comparing to McCalla, but is also under construction. And again, we expect to have this open late 2012. I didn't mention the third one. It's in Harrisburg. That's an existing terminal. I don't have a picture of it, but we're also expanding there as well. So those are the four terminals we're aiming for in 2012. Moving on to Virginia, there's really two types of projects that you see in this diagram. You've got the blues. Those are the ones that we have completed thanks to the Rail Enhancement Fund program. And the yellow ones are the ones that are currently underway thanks to the Rail Enhancement Fund program. I think we've had a very good partnership with Virginia to get these things done. I think these are projects that, you know, it'd be hard for us to make the case to do it on our own. But by teaming up with Virginia, teaming up with a public entity, we can make a really good case to do these projects. So let's look at the ones that are active. We've got Berryville, Elkton, and Roanoke. This is an existing agreement that we have. They're all under the same agreement. It's a total budget of $34.5 million. Berryville and Elkton are both siding extensions. Roanoke is what we call an interlocking signal renewal project. It will include provisions for a future Roanoke passenger station. In the case of the sidings, we expect to get those complete sometime mid-2012. Again, we're broken dirt there as well. And Roanoke is currently under design review. Just give you some pictures of what's going on in Elkton. You know, in the foreground, you can see the track ties being laid. You can see the ditch being put into place. And that's our main line with one of our intermodal trains with some single-stack and double-stack containers in the back of the train. This is one of the bridges that we have to build that's parallel to our existing main. We've got to build a second bridge. This is near the Miller Coors facility that is in Elkton, Virginia. Again, this is the progress we've made so far, and we expect to get this done mid-2012. This is still Elkton. Again, another picture from that same culvert, just looking the other direction. This is the north end of Elkton on a slightly rainier day. Again, you can see that the switch has been put into place and we've got the ties laid all the way down going to the culvert and then to the southern end of the siding. Moving on to Berryville, this is the north end of Berryville. Again, a Norfolk Southern double stack train. Again, this is what our kind of freight, this is what things will look like as we build up traffic on Crescent. This is another view a little bit further south looking at Berryville. And this is the south end of Berryville. So, again, I'm looking north at this point. You can see we've got the switch in place and are ready to cut in the rest of the siding. So there's two pieces of this that are working, the south end and the north end. South is a little further ahead than the north, but, again, we expect to have this done mid-2012. In terms of the public benefits that we talk about with Crescent, I think this slide gives a good idea of long-term what we see as public benefits. It's about getting trucks off the road, diverting that traffic to rail as much as we can, saving fuel, and reducing emissions. And we see those benefits as being very tangible and very achievable in the long-term for Crescent Corridor. The next big project is the Norfolk Passenger Train, and I know Kevin Page is going to go into that in a little more detail. So we'll just give you an overview of what we have going on there. There's several partners that are listed there, and really this project would not be possible if you didn't have all these partners working together. We've got the essential infrastructure under construction, and we're looking to get the full build out of this project completed by the end of 2013. This gives you an overview of what we have going on, just working west to east. In Petersburg, Virginia, we have a new connection track between the CSX and Norfolk Southern. That is well under construction at this point. We have a new freight siding at New Bohemia that we're going to be putting in. That'll help alleviate freight congestion. Installation of what we call CTC traffic control for the entire main line, so that allows our dispatchers to control this track remotely. Allows for flexibility of traffic between freight and passenger trains. Track extensions in Portlock Yard. Norfolk, Virginia, we're building a new station. That is also well under construction. And a new turning and service facility in Norfolk at St. Julian's Avenue. Just again, a couple pictures of what we have going on. This is the new connection track. So this is connecting CSX to Norfolk Southern. You can see that track is in place. The stone has been put in place, and we just have to run through with the tampers to put that stone between the ties. This is a look at the Norfolk Harbor Park Station. I believe this picture was taken by Kevin Page about a week ago. And this is a picture of what it looks like as of yesterday. You can see we've got the lamps in place, the gates are up, and this is moving along very, very well. There's a few things we still have to do, namely tying in the signaling and removing a signal bridge at the south end. Moving on to the servicing facility, this is the Amtrak crew building. Again, nothing fancy, simple, and utilitarian. This is another part looking at the St. Julian's Avenue servicing facility for Amtrak. So this is at Roberts Road looking west in this case. And the crew building you just saw will be at the far end of this. In this case, you can see that the lights are up, the servicing platform is in place, and most of the track, except for what's going over the road there, has been constructed. And that's all I have in terms of formal presentation. I'd be happy to take your questions on any of the projects.
Quick question, going back to your number of vehicle or tractor trailers diverted. Do you have an account? I assume the $878,000 was statewide.
Yeah, that is statewide, and that is looking long term. So that's not what we're doing right now. We're looking at in 2020.
Do we have any? Is there anything being done? I mean, what are we getting accomplished right now?
If you look at in terms of traffic, you mean
tractor trailer traffic.
Tractor trailer traffic. Probably the best barometer I have right now is what we have in Heartland Corridor, which was a corridor that was completed about a year ago. And we saw 139% increase year over year over what we were doing effectively before Heartland. And there we're seeing a 13% organic growth. In terms of exact numbers of trailers, I don't have that today. But we are seeing a positive trend.
So in other words, we don't know how much has been diverted, for example, from 81 or 95 at this point in time.
At this point, no. I don't have that yet.
Mr. Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hecker, I know Mr. Miller is going to have a presentation or a submission later, but I'd take this time to publicly thank Norfolk Southern for all its efforts. I know you mentioned the other partners, but it lets you guys know we really appreciate all you've done in working with not only the state, but the Hampton Roads region with this passenger rail, and just want to make that public acknowledgement to you.
Yeah, thank you. And I just want to add, I mean, we see these projects as very important, and we're looking at the Norfolk passenger train, things like that. That's our hometown. We want to see those things be successful, and really they're not possible unless you can get the buy-in and the partnership from all those other entities. So
Mr.
we view it the same way.
Mr. Hector, could you go back one slide, please?
Yes, sir.
This is just for illustration for the board. This is a picture of something we're going to functionally talk about in later on, and this is the this is where the train will be overnight and will be serviced. And because of some issues here, if you see the warehouse in the background here, we're basically cutting off access to that warehouse because we've got to close roads to service the warehouse. close one or two of the roads to service the warehouse. And so we're going to be looking at later on in our present or in our meeting today some stuff that will be associated with that picture, which is basically getting rid of that warehouse and doing some other stuff over there. So I just wanted to sort of draw your attention to that situation because of that because of the safety requirements associated with the train being there. We have to close a couple roads, and it's going to have an impact on that facility as well as one other down the track a little bit. So that's when we talk about it, that's what we're talking about.
Chairman, Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Sirich.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Thank you so much for being here. I second what Mr. Lane has said. You're a great Virginia company, and I appreciate all you're doing working with Thelma and all the folks in our rail department. Also appreciate Rob Martinez. I served on the Commonwealth Transportation Board when he was chairman of that board, and I hope you'll send him our best. How many cars do you think you can get off 81? Do we have an idea, or trucks, I mean?
The best number that I have for you today is what I have on that slide in terms of long term. I can tell you that just from the projections when we looked at some of these forecasts, a lot of it was pre-recession, and so there's been a dip. Obviously over the last 2 years. And I think the good news is that we're seeing that intermodal traffic come back. If you look at our earnings presentation from, say, the third quarter, we saw that intermodal traffic overall was up 8%, 13% of that. So the split between domestic and international, 13% was domestic. So we were up 13% for the domestic side and up 7% on the international side. And we really view that as a very positive sign that things are headed in the right direction compared to where they were 2 years ago. So, I think when we come back in a year or two and we're looking at how these projects are doing, plus the ones that we've added, we're cautiously optimistic that if that trend continues, we'll be able to give you a better answer to that question.
But you think the Crescent really could contribute significantly to improving the situation on 81 by moving more freight by rail?
I think there's really no mistake about it. In terms of what the capability of rail, particularly as we get the system built up, and it's not just the Virginia projects, but it's those terminals that we have. I mean, those are big anchors at the end of the line that are going to make our service that we can provide in terms of the time it takes to get from a location like Memphis up to the Northeast is going to be significantly improved. And when you add in all of the other pieces, such as the sidings, speed improvements, it's a network effect. So it's not just one project. It's hard to measure off of one project, but say over a longer time frame, and when you look at when all the projects are in service and what the services that we're able to deliver, I think our expectations are definitely that we can make a contribution to alleviating that kind of traffic congestion and move those loads to rail.
I think that's great because what we've seen in my area, significant truck traffic on rail now as a result of the inland port in Front Royal. That has helped 66 tremendously to get truck traffic off Route 66 and onto the rail. So, more power to you. Thank you.
Let me hear Mr. Martin,
yes,
and then Mr. Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Chairman. I understand it was not part of this presentation, but what can you tell us about the intermodal facility in Elliston?
In Elliston, that facility, now I know we just went through the court case, and I know things are in a position to move forward, and it kind of that's a good segue from the previous question about the economy and how when we originally looked at Elliston, we were in the mid-2000s and it was pre-recession. And we're looking to see that traffic come back to the point where the demand justifies us getting started on that project. I think right now we're looking at what we need to do to make the network more efficient, to run trains at a more reliable service level, to run them faster. And from our perspective, the things like the sidings, the speed improvements on the main line at this point are taking a higher priority than Elliston at this point. It's not to say it won't get done at some point in the future, and I think we're certainly open to monitoring the demand and seeing when that traffic comes back, that we would come back and look at that project again.
Mr. Chairman, I want to compliment Norfolk Southern as well, but I don't want us to leave this meeting today thinking that Norfolk Southern is the solution to the problems of traffic on Interstate 81. And I think Norfolk Southern would agree that they can contribute to helping to relieve a small, very small portion of the truck traffic on 81. But the improvements that are needed to Interstate 81 are obvious and are not in any way related significantly to the ability of Norfolk Southern to take those trucks off of 81. And it has to do with the fact that so many of them are going through Virginia. They're not actually originating in Virginia. That is part of that. And I just don't want to make, I want to make sure that we don't have a misunderstanding here that that's a substitute for the improvements that need to be made to Interstate 81. And I compliment Norfolk Southern for the work they're doing to help relieve some of that.
I'm Bruce Wingo with Norfolk Southern. All along with the talk we've had of helping with the truck traffic on 81, we have said that we are not the whole solution. I hope everybody does understand that. But we have emphasized that we can certainly help with the growth. And, you know, the growth projections are scary. So we can definitely help with
that. What's already there, Mr. Chairman, is scary, plus Detroit growth as well.
Can't argue with that.
Okay, Mr. Cole.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hecker, thanks for being here. Good job with the presentation. What would Norfolk Southern say are the one or two biggest challenges or concerns regarding accomplishing these projects?
You know, I think really from us, it's if we had more of the manpower to do this stuff, from our standpoint, we have our engineering resources pretty much maxed out at this point. And so there's a limitation to how much we can do in any given year. When you look at what we're trying to tackle right now between the passenger train project, which is a huge undertaking, on top of what we have in Virginia, plus what we have in the 22,000-mile network, you know, those are the challenges that we have to overcome in terms of budgeting when we can get this stuff done. The other thing to remember is that, you know, we have some of our best resources in the company working on positive train control, which is a unfunded mandate from the federal government. And there's no question that that is pulling resources that could otherwise be put into other projects. You know, we try not to bite off more than we can finish on our plate. We like to push ourselves, but we know there's limitations to how much we can get done in any given year.
But you don't see any significant variables that could turn against you through the project?
I don't think so. I mean, I think we've clearly established a good track record working with the REF program. I mean, it's something we want to see it continue. It's worked very well for the projects we've already completed. It's working well for the projects we're working on right now. And I think if we see that program continue, that's really the best thing that can happen for Virginia and for us to move forward with Crescent and other initiatives as fast as we can.
Good. Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
All right.
Chairman, just one more quick question.
Mr. Rich.
What more, if anything, can the Commonwealth do to help you? You mentioned a lot of things that we have done in the partnership. Is there anything else we can do to move some of these projects along, especially in the Crescent?
I'll take a stab at that, and then I'll maybe defer to Bruce and see if he has any other thoughts. I think, just getting kind of back to your question about the REF program, I think what you've seen here just underscores the importance of keeping that going, keeping it funded, and communicating the need to folks who maybe aren't as familiar with rail, that this is a part of the solution. We're not coming here to say it's the panacea, but unless you're in the depths of this, you may not recognize that. And we're happy to help make those presentations, to help get that word out to people who need to be educated on the benefits of rail. Bruce, I don't know if you want to add some other thoughts there?
Just that, of course, Mark's already talked about how we are pushing our engineering people and so forth on all these projects. From your viewpoint, I would say you need to clone Thelma and Kevin because of how much help they are in making all these things come to pass.
Mr. Chairman, just one final question, and just for my curiosity, has there been any discussion or is there any even consideration for having passenger cars added to lines going down 81, anything along that line? I don't know if it's even feasible to mix it with freight. Probably too slow, but I was just wondering if there's any consideration at all of looking at passenger.
You're talking about running independent passenger trains or running passenger trains mixed with freight?
Well, either way, I just wonder if there's been any discussion in Norfolk Southern about looking at that feasibility.
Right now, no. There's really no. We're not looking at, certainly not mixing it with freight. And there is no active project or any plan to get passenger service down that line.
Well, one of the things I thought from prior discussions and all was that there's a couple of reasons. One is because of speed. It's a windy track down through that area. And the other is I think the reason railroads have gotten away from some passenger anyway is because of the liability aspect. It's a lot better to deal with freight than it is to people. But that was just something I had to.
There's definitely some truth to that. And as you mentioned, on our Valley line, the one that comes through Luray, that is not a very straight line. That was put in, I don't know, 1870s, 80s, way
it's
back.
It's actually 2 centuries ago now. So.
That's true. Century before last. Yeah. it doesn't lend itself readily for passenger service to have some decent speeds. Someday, but I would not say it's an active consideration at the moment.
I think it probably doesn't lend itself because it's a little bit slower, and our mindset as a public seems that we've got to be there over, you know, right away, and so we're not used to the leisurely travel that they used to have on rail, I guess.
So many people talk about high-speed rail. We try to correct the phraseology to higher-speed rail because Amtrak outside the Northeast Corridor does not run above 79 anywhere that I'm aware of in the country. And there are some plans to get it maybe 10 miles or so more than that in some places. But then you would have to have really dedicated passenger track. You could not mix it with freight. And, of course, that's a whole other world of expense and additional right-of-way.
Just to add, I mean, just to give you an idea and add on to what Bruce said, when you look at what we're doing for Norfolk, effectively from Petersburg down to Suffolk, it is a straight shot. There isn't a curve on that railroad. We can, once we get the track upgraded, once we get the signaling upgraded, we can do 79 miles an hour. You compare that to the Valley Line. Even if we got the improvements made for sidings for freight trains, the ability for a passenger train to run the kinds of speeds you're running here just wouldn't be there because you got too many curves. You don't have straight shots. You're going up. You're going down. It's a much, much older line. It doesn't have the favorable geography that something like that has.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Next item will be the financial report, John Lawson.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. Clicking on the wrong button here. At this point, I would give you a little update on where the financial position for VDOT stands through December. Starting off with revenues, state revenue collections through the month of December are just over 1% ahead of where they were last fiscal year through December. The growth that you're seeing here is good. It's still, though, slightly behind the official growth rate of 2.2%. Motor vehicle sales and use taxes, it continues to grow. That's one of our bigger performers this year. Seems that the economy is not slowing down the car buying as much as anticipated. Growth in this area is pushing 5%, which is ahead of forecast. Motor fuel tax collections, though, continue to remain below forecast. We're looking at an estimated forecast for the year now of about just over 1% decline over the prior fiscal year. The reported data today, through December is showing a decline of about 5%. State sales and use tax collections have increased over 5% a year, and that is pretty much on target forecast. I do want to point out that there was some revenues, December revenues, about $23 million that were actually collected in December but actually not received and posted until January. So when you include those additional revenues, instead of showing a 1.1% growth rate over prior year, we're really at about 3%. This just gives you an illustration by the details by major revenue source. Again, as I mentioned, some of these reporting items actually look a little better than they appear on this chart due to that delayed posting of some December revenues. From a federal revenue perspective, we're almost on par with where we were last fiscal year. We collected $585 million through December. There's some differences, construction being down from prior year with offsetting increases in other areas such as the maintenance program and our ARRA projects as they continue to move forward. From a spending perspective, we're about 13% ahead of where we were last year. We spent just over $2 billion, about $240 million more than in the prior fiscal year. When you look at the spending from a major category perspective, about 45% of the spending relates to VDOT maintenance. About 48% is maintenance related when you consider both VDOT maintenance and maintenance payments to localities. Looking at construction, it relates to about 36% of total expenditures. This graphically just illustrates by those major program areas the spending year over year between 2011 and 2012 and 2011. You see the most of your minor programs are pretty much on track with prior year, and you see the major increase in spending on maintenance. This slide shows you the anticipated spending performance. You can see here that we are collectively about $180 million below our forecasted spending through December. Again, some of this decrease is related to some changes that we've made. It's been made internally. Cardinal, you heard Deputy Commissioner make reference to our new financial system, Cardinal, just a few moments ago. As with any new system, we're having some minor bugs we're working through, as well as just learning processes that we're having to go through as we bring up the new system. December was the first month of the new op system. Conversion actually went very well. But again, we're just getting acclimated and working through the new system. We did have some higher than expected activity in November, kind of anticipation of the system coming online in December. You were seeing that in your December report that was in the package. Turning to the maintenance program, through December, we're about almost 50% ahead of where we were in last fiscal year through December of 2010. The spending is on the $86 million roughly that was spent in December. It was a little low compared to the spend plan, but we actually recorded $200 million in expenditures in November, which was considerably above the spend plan. So when you look at the year-to-date, we're coming in about $150 million behind where we thought we would be through the end of December. Looking through the end of the year, we're still forecasting to spend about $1.8 billion in the maintenance program, which, based on our program allocations, will leave us with about $180 million balance. Construction continues to spend at about where we would have expected it to be. We are slightly behind where we were this time last year. As I mentioned a couple months ago, we did have some major projects that were kind of finalized at the beginning of this year that has led to some lower construction numbers this fiscal year than previous fiscal year.
Chairman? Mr. Lane?
I'm just going to ask, the spending on the PPTA projects, what is that showing here?
That would show here.
It show here once it happens.
In construction,
okay.
Correct.
Okay.
Once it's incurred, those expenditures would show as part of the construction program.
Thank you.
Ms. Lawson, can you go back to the maintenance program slide? Does bullet three mean that our balances are going to increase by $180 million?
What bullet three is saying is at the end of the carryover, at the end of fiscal year 2012, is expected to be $180 million.
More than the allocation?
We will have not spent $180 million
total
of our allocation.
For just that year, or in total, that would be what's left?
In total, including the carry forward from the prior year.
Okay, because the way I read it, it was like we were adding 180 to whatever we carried forward that we were behind before.
No, what this is doing is we're bringing down the roughly $500 million balance we had
to 180.
To about 180.
Okay, so we're gonna bring it down by 320 or so.
Yes, sir.
Or 60 some percent. Great, thank you.
And Mr. Miller, members of the board, after we get a handle on particularly this snow season and how we end with that, there may be some additional contracts we might try to let in the February or March time frame.
Keep going like we're going. We're going to have some money.
Yes.
Thank you.
Knock on wood.
This is the construction work and maintenance work underway slide that I've been showing you now for several months. And you can see how we are continuing to spend down the maintenance contract balances. You know, it's the blue line. Contract values have fallen off as we're kind of ending the season with most of those contracts, and we'll be seeing those ramp back up in the spring as we go out with the new contracts for next year. From a cash perspective, we are about $320 some odd million below where we started the fiscal year. Most of those changes are in the highway maintenance and operating fund, supporting the increased levels of maintenance expenditure. And you also have a reduction in our bond funds as it relates to the capital projects bonds that were sold last May as we're spending down those balances. In summary, state revenues are tracking slightly below forecast, but are seeming to be falling pretty close in line as we head toward the end of the year. From a program spending perspective, most of the programs are spending in line with their forecast. We do are a little trailing a little bit in construction and maintenance, but those numbers continue to look solid. In terms of maintenance spending, as I mentioned earlier, we are spending lower than forecast through December. Some of that, again, mentioned is related to this mild winter we've been blessed to have. And looking forward, as we mentioned, from a maintenance balance perspective, we are expecting that the balance will end the year at about $180 million, a significant improvement from the balance we had at the end of 2011.
Yes, Mr. Commissioner. John, remember Chuck mentioned there's 500 jobs unfilled in his presentation. Is that budgeted? Are those jobs budgeted?
Will they represent, if they're not filled, a savings of, I just ran a pretty quick calculation, it could be $20 million.
Air positions are funded within the budget. Maybe look at almost half of air positions are funded within the maintenance program. So if there are the funds are there to support the program, so whether we're paying a contractor or paying an employee, the dollar is still within the program. So
still being spent, though, or not?
Being spent.
Still being spent.
So it doesn't necessarily directly relate to us.
That answers my question. Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Fee. John, can you please remind me of the non-federal dollars, the state dollars? How much of that is going into construction, if any, or or is it all going into maintenance?
At this point, outside of some of the special programs like revenue sharing,
right.
All of the state funds are being used to support the construction or the maintenance program.
Okay.
You know, we have, since 2009 was the last year that there was any funding available for formula distribution.
It's like 90-95% is going into maintenance.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Just a comment, Mr. Lawson. I mean, you mentioned the bonds. Of course, you, I'm sure, keeping up what's happening in municipal bond markets the last few weeks, and our issuance of rates continue to go down with the dearth of issuances out there, we should expect probably pretty good premiums and, you know, some monies over and above what we probably budgeted.
Yeah, yes. In terms of, you know, we have the Garvey sale that is that we'll be pricing in mid-February and expect to close March 1st. They should price very well in this market, probably in the 4% range.
And we're scheduled to meet with the rating agencies next week.
Next week.
So by the next meeting, Mr. Commissioner, we probably have an idea where that number is.
Yeah.
By 15th of February.
We'll be pricing on the 15th. So yes, sir.
Okay. It'll be an interesting day.
It'll be interesting.
AAA.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much. Mr. Pittert, the DRPT financial update.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. I just wanted to give a brief quarterly financial update for rail public transportation. And some of these slides are going to be similar to what we've seen before. Basically, this is just giving you an idea of the package that you received. Should be hopefully on your computers. But the first statement that's in this package is we can call it resources and commitments. And basically what that's doing is taking all the contracts that we've led, all the grants that we've executed at our agency and put in our six-year program, and then matching that up to our resources that we have to honor those commitments. And then the net of that is essentially the funds that we have available at any point in time to either roll back into the six-year improvement plan process or to allow y'all to do an off-cycle grant potential. With that being said, this is a sort of a snapshot of that statement that's in your package, and I want to focus on really two areas on this statement. The funds available at the bottom line, which is what I was just talking about, which is funds in both rail and transit that are available to us to potentially use on projects. And now some of those, there's a little more detail behind these funds available, so when you see funds available in rail, for instance, some of those funds are tied back to the Virginia Transportation Act of 2000, so they have a specific use, specific construction district that they have to use those funds in, with some of them being in the Bristol district. So the opportunities for use are limited for us at this time. So, but with that said, that's the point of this game, is to try to give y'all an idea of what monies are available if potential project comes to light. The other item I want to focus on this statement is the cash, and just got a few slides on analysis of our cash balances. And the point of this is we're trying to make sure that our funds are being utilized and they're not just sitting in the bank. So we've kind of set some standard reserve balances of 60 days on our transit funds and 90 days on our rail funds. And so we're trying to manage to having that much of, sort of speak, a cash reserve on hand. And on the transit side, we've done a really good job. Even though we had a blip earlier in the year where we had our contract, our amendments to our contracts, and some of our grantees had some difficulty signing that amendment, we built up some operating funds. That whole issue's passed us. Those funds have been sent out, and we're still below our the working needs average that we're trying to attain. On the rail side, and I'm going to have some other slides that get in a little more detail, about the rails side in a second. But before I go there, this is just a graphical representation of the balances, and you see that blip in the transit side that I was talking about, where we built up over a $60 million balance there while we were working through that contractual issue. But we're back down around $40 million, and I think I made a note here that, you know, maybe going forward that we might want to take a look at, is the $60 million balance the right level or not? Because I think over time we've been around the $40 million balance. So we'll take a look at that as we move forward. And then that brings us to the rail side, which you see here, we've steadily been just adding more and more cash as the revenue came in. But you will see at the very end of that orange line that it does drop in that last month. And I guess what's happened here is we did reach a peak for rail in the last quarter, and then the last month we actually had expenditures start coming in for the Norfolk Train project, which is where a big majority of our commitments are right now on the rail side. So, and we actually, the cash flow that you see in these statements is looking at things as if expenditures were expected to be ratable throughout the year. But the reality of it is, in the Norfolk Train project, we knew that the expenditures were going to be backloaded in the last 6 months. So we saw that starting to happen in December, and we expect more expenditures to occur in the next quarter. In fact, I know through this month, we've already expended more than the revenue we collected. So I think we're finally getting over that hurdle where we're going to see those cash balances in rail being put to use. Along those lines, also it gets back to us doing a better job managing our projects. So some of it is, and you'll, in a later slide when I'm looking at the budget, some of it for us is looking at our cash flows on our projects a little closer, and that's working with our grantees, the Norfolk Southerns, the CSXs, to better understand when we're going to spend those funds on these rail projects. With transit, it's a lot of projects, but it's a lot of bus purchases or purchases of a bus shelter, and those are projects that we can predict the timing a lot easier than we can on a rail project. Yes?
Just a quick question. What on the transit cash balance, what are the agreements, what types of agreements were executed that started bringing that cash fund down?
Essentially, we had an amendment to our standard master agreement where we wanted to have the ability, if we so chose, that we could be, and the law allows, that we could be added to a transit entity's board. We serve on, out of about 60 entities, we serve on maybe about 10 of the boards throughout the state, the transit entities, and we kind of saw a need that, you know, if we're starting to make a larger investment in these entities, we may want to have a seat at the board. And so we had an amendment to allow that if the law allowed it. Obviously, if a board is elected city officials, we can't change that.
I'm a little bit confused, though. What would that have to do with cash balance?
Well, essentially, some people didn't sign the agreements, so the operating funding they were getting for this year was held up because some people pushed back and were nervous we were trying to take over their board. And so it took us, I think, till November until we finally worked through that. But then once those were signed, the funds went out the door.
Yes, Steve, on the Lynchburg train, I understand the governor put it in his budget that it would be funded, but is it coming out of this rail balance?
Well, I guess the Lynchburg train is essentially has funded itself.
Yeah.
So, and produced enough excess to fund the Richmond side of that endeavor.
But it's coming out of this rail balance in essence, or?
There is a $6 million balance that's dedicated out of that commitments for rails that is dedicated to that project.
Okay.
But I guess my point to you is the project is generating more revenue than expenditure.
Yeah. And then which the second question, how are we on the negotiations with Amtrak on the renewal? Isn't that coming up, or have y'all done that?
For the next year we're done.
And is that going to allow us to still make a profit on that train?
The revenue is all two trains together, and respectfully, the revenue is mixed together for the two trains under contract.
excuse me.
All right. Thanks.
All
right.
Jane, any other questions?
Exactly. That's all right. So we're going to try to do a better job managing our projects, and that's two items: get better cash flows, and secondly, when projects are completed, go ahead and push for the final billing and get those projects closed out so we can move the funds onto projects that are moving forward. Next, I just have a slide, and this is in your package also in a little more detail, but it's basically just a budget to actual, and this is where on the rail side, to some degree, you know, we're showing at 82% that we're off from where we should be, but that 6 months budget is ratable per month, and really some of those expenditures were expected to be backloaded in the last half of the year. Some of it is there are some projects that have fallen behind. Noakesville to Calverton is one of those. Kevin will address that shortly. So that's one of the issues I want to talk about here. The other, and I have some bullets about it, is the Dulles item. And basically, there's one. We have about $11 million left to send to Dulles of bond funding from $125 million of bond funding that was dedicated to that project 2 years ago. And I guess we're in the middle of doing a review of the supporting documentation of where that funding went, and we're waiting until we finish that review before that last $11 million is remitted. And we're hopeful that we're close to being done with that, but that's why I anticipated we would have been done by now, but we're not. But hopefully in the next month we'll be complete with that. And with that, if there's any other questions, I'll be glad to answer them.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. With rail industrial access, Kevin Page.
Thank you, Vice Chairman Worley and members of the board. We have a special consideration today with Purdue Agribusiness Incorporated. Agribusiness Incorporated, which is run by Purdue, is one of the private grain export terminals within the city of Chesapeake, right here on the Norfolk Portsmouth Beltline Railroad. The Norfolk Portsmouth Beltline is one of our short line railroads. It's jointly owned by Norfolk Southern and CSX, but operated as an independent entity. It's a recipient of our rail preservation fund, so we do support the continuation of rail service of this line. And also, Purdue Agribusiness is a large customer of the Norfolk Portsmouth Beltline. One of the unique properties of this application is that, as you all know, the import-export industry moves so quickly that sometimes private industry can't slow down long enough for our governmental process to move through through the system. Purdue Agribusiness was faced with a large export-driven opportunity for increasing the grain exports of Virginia grain and Eastern Shore grain up the Delmarva Peninsula to be exported under agreement to East Asia. Having said that, they moved forward with a project ahead of our grant application process. But we've gone ahead and accepted that application and moved forward with the recommendation today on behalf of board member Aubrey Lane to move forward with a project that has a $700,000 rail siding for 1,620 carloads per year will go across this siding, as well as they currently employ 109 people at the terminal. Our contract administration prohibits going back and recommending for funding under the CTB adopted policies for projects that have occurred after the fact of the grant. So as the application is received, we go to the board member of the respective jurisdiction and district. The local jurisdiction has passed a resolution, the City of Chesapeake, on December the 13th of 2011, recommending the project move forward. They feel it's a very large economic development opportunity for them, for this private industry to move forward with this export operation. As well as this project scored 58 points out of 100. So if we had come forward under the normal process, we would have recommended it hands down without any exception. As a part of that, we will have to have that special exception from the board and its action today brought forward by Member Lane to move forward with this project. Just in reference, this is a $700,000 rail project that we are recommending $105,000 of, because under the policies and procedures of the board, $105,000 is the 15% is what is considered to be the cap of this project. Mr. Vice Chairman, I'll pass this back over to you, sir, for any questions of the board, and thank you for this opportunity.
Any questions?
Just a comment. This is really sort of, I looked at it, form over substance. This was
an agreement to ship grain to Far East China. The crop came in. They had to get the rail in place to get it out. And so that's why they didn't meet the specific criteria. But if you'd have scored it, as Mr. Page has pointed out, it would have done very well. We would have recommended it. So that's why I've asked the board for the exception.
All right. Thank you very much. Next item is the Richmond Hampton Roads Intercity Passenger Rail. Kevin.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman, members of the board. Moving right along with the agenda, we have a project here moving forward that Mr. Hecker from Norfolk Southern just gave you a quick overview on. This is a great milestone opportunity for us today because we're going to try to set up the funding in place today to complete this project, as well as moving forward with an announcement as to when we think we might be able to begin rail service. Under this project, we continue to move forward. As you all may remember, at the board level, the Commonwealth Transportation Board, over several allocations of funding, has allocated $102.6 million of rail enhancement funds to this project under special authority granted through the General Assembly through the Appropriations Act to utilize these funds for passenger rail purposes for Norfolk. A multi-year funding agreement has been moving forward with both CSX and Norfolk Southern. I'd like to just talk a little bit today, if I can, just in break on this, is that CSX and Norfolk Southern have come together on a state-funded project that will be advancing an intercity passenger rail initiative that has probably not been done as quickly anywhere else in the history of the United States in its current present history. So as Mr. Hecker talked about today, how busy Norfolk Southern is on their project with the Crescent Corridor, as you all may recall a few months back, Quentin Kendall was here talking about the National Gateway Project, which is another huge major infrastructure for CSX initiative. So they're both going full tilt, as it may be, to move forward, but still finding a way to help us get this project up and running as soon as possible. As we move forward with the final budget and schedule, we've identified another $11.999 million that needs the costs that have come about that have arisen for many purposes, including which, as you all know, the crash walls that we've added on at Harbor Park Station, the trash train track for freight interference that we talked about a little bit, Mr. Hecker mentioned as well as doing some additional line of road improvements to enhance the train operations and keep the speeds where they are to where we can make a good schedule. Moving forward with that, we also have the siding into Bohemia, St. Julian's train servicing facility. We have a little property down there that we need to deal with. I do believe that Mr. Miller, your disrupt down there, had also brought that up in Mr. Hecker's presentation about that one parcel that we're faced with, as well as we're working with a CSX railroad crossing in Suffolk where the two railroads cross. We're trying to upgrade that hard crossing, they call it, for speed purposes, as well as meeting some ADA requirements that have come about at the Harbor Park Station. Having said that, we went back to Norfolk Southern and says, okay, we need to move a project in order to fund a project. And Norfolk Southern very quickly, as CFO Pittard had mentioned earlier, the Noakesville to Calverton project had not moved forward, as Mr. Hecker indicated. The economy is where it is right now, and they're focusing on some other higher yield projects like the Berryville and the Elkton siding before they do the Noakesville to Calverton double tracks. Norfolk Southern came to Director Drake, says we will move that project to outer years. We will free up the cash that's been allocated in this current fiscal year for that project, therefore basically giving us the opportunity through their cooperation to go ahead and make the recommendation and request today for funding to complete this project, this very important project with both Norfolk Southern and CSX and DRPT and Amtrak, and also move Noakesville to Calverton out to fiscal year 15 and 16, which is going to realign this project more into a realistic build schedule to get back to what Mr. Pittard was talking about earlier as to how we line up our projects with cash flow. So having said that, the most important bullet of this slide, in addition to that, is that Norfolk Southern came to us. CSX has worked with Director Drake as well. We feel that enough projects will be in place to start this train on December 31st, by no later than December 31st of this year. I think that's just a great opportunity for all of us. It shows how we, the agency, our partners, the railroad, Amtrak, and this Commonwealth Transportation Board and the General Assembly can move forward with a rail passenger intercity transportation initiative very similar to what we did in Lynchburg and also to Richmond, how we can move quickly on projects and get those results out to the public to start bearing that benefit as soon as possible. So I think this is a great milestone for us today to be able to say publicly that we have a goal now that we will ask the Commonwealth Transportation Board to embrace with us through this action. If there are any questions, Mr. Vice Chairman, I'll point it back to you for covering that. Thank you all for this time.
Any questions?
Mr. Chairman, just a comment, which I will not repeat when we get to the action agenda, but, you know, obviously Norfolk Southern and CSX have done a great job working with us on this project. Mr. Wingo gave due credit to Director Drake and Kevin and Steve and the whole folks in rail and public transportation. It's sort of amazing, and I'm not a transportation expert or I don't do it for a living like these guys do and ladies do, but to get this service up as fast as it's going to get up is just amazing. And I guess, Kevin, what did we talk about originally, or Director? Originally was the goal date was
October of 13th.
Right. So you know, transportation projects, as we all know, never seem to do this. And so here we set what we thought was a realistic goal of October 2013. And Kevin, I think we need to hit 12-12-12.
That's great.
We'll try.
Okay, so you got 19 days. I'm shaving you back a little bit. But it will be a great thing for Hampton Roads and for Virginia, and I just want to thank the staff and particularly Norfolk Southern and CSX for their role in this. They have been more than helpful.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions? Comments? Okay. Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you.
The next item will be moving road from secondary to primary systems of highway. Hoffer.
Still good morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
Working at moving some, or recommending moving some roads from the secondary system to the primary system. The authority for that is given in the code. There are two sections that govern it. One, subsection A, deals with normal transfers from secondary to primary system, requires CTV approval, and is limited to 50 miles a year. Subsection B, which was introduced in the code last year, allowed commissioner's approval with no CTV action required, but it was limited to changes due to completed construction projects, maintenance projects, and the like. And there is no mileage limitation for that particular one. The criteria that we have to follow was set by a CTV resolution back in 1998, and for a facility to be considered, it has to meet a majority of the criteria in that resolution, linking interstate highways, serving sites of historic interest or county seats, a minimum traffic volume of 2,000 vehicles per day, and then certain other percentages as in out-of-state vehicles, light and medium duty trucks, tractor trailers, and trip lengths. Why are we looking at it? In the VDOT business plan, there is an element for evaluating the transfer of selected secondary highways to the primary highway system. In addition, we received resolutions from the Prince William County Board of Supervisors and the Fairfax County Board of Supervisors to transfer the facilities. We use studies from VDOT historical modeling data, and in addition to that, Fairfax County paid for a study themselves for their facilities. Which ones are we talking about? We're talking about the Prince William County Parkway, which is Route 3000. It goes from Route 1 to Route 234. It's a divided highway, arterial, speed limits up to 55 miles per hour, and carries up to 54,000 vehicles per day. There's a short segment of it that's in the city of Manassas, so that's not a secondary. And the remainder of it is 15.9 miles long. Fairfax County Parkway, Route 7100. Goes from Route 1 to Route 7, or at least it will when it's completed. It's a divided highway, again an arterial, speeds up to 55 miles per hour, carries up to 75,000 cars a day, and it's approximately a total length of 32 and a half miles long, but only 24 miles are right now in the secondary system. Those would require CTV approval for the transfer, where the remaining 8.5 miles would require the commissioner's approval after their paperwork has been completed and submitted. Franconia Springfield Parkway, Route 79, again in Fairfax County.
Question.
goes from Beulah Road to Fairfax County Parkway. It is a limited access divided highway, 250 miles per hour, carries up to 57,000 cars a day, length of 3.7 miles, and again, some of it's not officially in the system yet. There's 3.1 miles in the secondary system and 0.6 that are not yet in the system. Now, comparing that to the CTV resolution regarding the elements you have to meet to be accepted, all of them meet at least half of them. I would like to point out that we did not study some of the elements, and that was mostly due to cost. To get the out-of-state percentage, we had to do a traffic license plate survey, and when we calculated out, that would have cost almost $40,000, and we decided to save the money since the facility's already met at least half of the requirements. The impacts of the transfer. There would be an impact to the primary construction formula. Nova's share would increase by 2.3%. Now, I'd like to point out that's not Nova's share increasing by 2.3% of Nova's share. That's 2.3% of the statewide. In other words, they go from about 18% to about 20%. But 20% of zero is still zero. There would be no immediate impact based on that. There is an impact on maintenance conditioning reporting because that is by system. And that would move about 50 miles from the secondary to the primary system. There would be some impact there. Not really sure what it is because not all of the secondary highway mileage gets done every year. So can't tell you exactly what the impact would be, but it would be minimal. And then there would be an operations cost because we'd have to revise signing, directional route markers, things like that, and it was estimated for that to cost about $200,000 for all three facilities. The next steps, a resolution will be brought to the board next month by Maintenance Division, which is in charge of these kinds of actions, and then the commissioner would accept newly built portions with paperwork finished and other items that are done under his authority. We'd also like to consider revising the criteria. We haven't looked at transfers to the primary system in quite some time, and when we went back and did that, we took a look at the 1998 resolution and found that it was really mostly based on a 1973 resolution, and a lot of the information in there, A, the way we do our counts now, it's hard to get, costs money, and B, is it really relevant? Is the percentage of trucks important, or is it the number of trucks you're carrying important if you're looking at freight movement? Things like that. So we'd like to look at those things, revisit those issues with you guys at some other time. In addition to that, we would like to also start a statewide review, looking using readily available data to see what other facilities might come close, at least, to meeting the requirements to be transferred over to the primary system. Questions?
Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Is there a particular reason these three road segments were chosen as compared to a number of others?
Well, these particular three, we received requests from those local governments to transfer them. And they carry a very high volume of traffic compared to others.
I know that, I hate to say this, but squeaky wheel. I mean, for years, local governments up there have always complained as to how can you consider these roads, given what they carry, secondary roads. So
especially that former chairman in Prince William.
Anyway, I didn't recognize. I was going to recognize Mr. Garzinski. Mr. Garzinski.
Yes, Mr. Secretary, just for the edification of my fellow CTV members who aren't from Northern Virginia, Fairfax County Parkway and its extension and Prince William are the major roads beside the interstate that go through the Northern Virginia area. And no matter what new criteria we come up with, they will meet it because, as we stated, the volume is just there. And they are major. They dissect the counties. That's all I needed. Just wanted to add to that so you know that.
So we can do 50 a year, right?
You can do up to 50 for immediate action, and then The remainder would either have to wait for another year or could be taken into the commissioner's authority if they were the result of a construction project, a maintenance project, or other improvement.
Mr. Chairman.
I think what Dr. Davis and others would probably be interested in is, you know, we're going to develop a pipeline of project
of yes.
roads. I mean, these three leap out just because the vehicle counts are just so enormous. But then obviously there'll be a desire to see this in other places. Up in Frederick County, there are some secondary roads, you know, right around where 81 and all of that are just tremendous volumes in other places in the Commonwealth. Mr. King.
Was the rationale for the limit on the mileage to be accepted based around that allocation formula, or does anyone know what the rationale was of having that limit at any one time moving miles to the primary
zero dollars in the past?
Mr. Chairman, I think the designation meant real dollars in the past. Yeah. With the current situation, it's not nearly the impact that it used to be in switching designation. But in the past, it would have meant a significant shift of dollars to do this.
Yes, sir.
But, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
We're hopeful that in the future
it will be that way again.
It will be that way. So every time we add, you know, the hope is that at some point it's going to come home to roost one way or the other. When you if you look at revising the criteria, particularly if we start to create a pipeline, it would seem to me that it wouldn't just be a pass-fail criteria. It might be biggest need criteria. You know, Mr. Karsinski's talked about the huge traffic counts on these two roads. And if you had something that met the minimum criteria but didn't sort of reach out and smack you a little bit, it might be nice from my perspective to have some sort of ranking of the ones that had the greatest need. And back to sort of some of my other comments earlier, not today but in earlier meetings, the greatest impact, greatest value that it brings to the Commonwealth. So if we do look at that criteria, I'd like to suggest that you look at it, some sort of ranking, and within it doesn't have to be hard and fast. We don't have to necessarily use the we don't necessarily have to agree with the ranking and take them in order, but it certainly would be helpful to show us which ones were by staff anyway or by the criteria were the most impactful.
Could you all come back with some? I mean, how are we going to go from here? That's really what the board says.
Well, certainly next month.
We'll take care of these. These are real low hanging fruit.
Correct.
But then where would we go from here?
After that, it depends on how fast the board would like to move. We can bring up for next month another workshop item showing what our proposed changes to the policy would be, and then next month after that, take it up. That would be perfectly fine.
May I ask another question, Mr.
Chairman? Sure, Ms. Miller.
I'm still learning, trying to learn. By putting this in a primary role, we're determining construction formula allocation by the amount of roads that exist in there already. Somebody help me with this. If I got a road and I'm totally meeting my need, okay, and it's a primary road, why does that drive what my construction dollars would be to that place? It seemed to me that it should be driven by, and maybe it's legislation or something, but it should be driven by what's the need. Yeah, not how many roads I have there already.
Mr. Chairman, it's also how you define need, because
of course it is.
If you decide need is only for interstate and primary, and that's where you're going to fund, you're not going to fund secondary roads, then you just move everything to primary, and the secondary is left high and dry with no improvements whatsoever, which is what we've seen recently.
Sure,
and that's why some of us are very leery of redesignation of roads without some consideration of some assurance that secondary roads are not going to be totally left out of the formula.
And you know,
I
agree with that, but it just seems to me that to say, because I've got this, let's pretend we have a new locality, and we'll call it X. And locality X has a perfect road system. We build everything we could possibly want to build there for the next 30 years. Well, let's send them to construction money because they already have roads there.
Is that what this is saying? Because that makes no sense.
It's not exactly. The way primary allocations are made between districts are set by code, and of that amount, you know, you have, let's say, $100 million to allocate to primary highways. Of that amount, 70% is allocated based upon vehicle miles traveled on primary system highways. 25% is allocated by how many lane miles of primary highways you have. And then 5% is basically a needs factor, which is determined by the board.
That makes no sense to me.
Yeah, it does, too.
Well, if vehicle miles travel on the road, if I've got, and I'm not going to belabor this, I'll do it offline, but vehicle miles traveled on the road will go to maintenance needs. But if it's totally taking all the traffic that I can put on it, then why does it drive construction? I mean, that makes no sense to me.
I'm not making no comment about nothing. Mr. Lane.
It seems to me we've got to have some type of relativity per district or per region assigned to this if we're going to go to that. I mean, I'll use the example we hear now on the national level, the 1%. Well, that 1% is a lot different depending on where you live. And so I guess what I would suggest to my colleagues as we go through here is that if we simply go to absolute values, it's going to steer. I think where Dr. Davis is afraid we don't want to. I don't think any of us want to go. So there has to be some relative criteria as to the importance to that either locality or how we define it. Otherwise, we're just going to simply get to where we're just pushing monies to the most used roads.
Yes,
Mr. Chairman, just one follow-up question on this. If we are shifting these three roads to primary from secondary, is there a commensurate amount of money going from secondary to primary since they were maintained or whatever under the previous system? You're just changing it without changing any dollars at all. So in other words, the other localities in the primary system are going to have a smaller piece of the pie.
Construction.
And the secondary situation is going to be the same, but with each of those possibly getting a little bit different.
Essentially, that's right.
And to be sort of brutally honest here, you tell me if I'm wrong, but I mean, we've essentially treated these as primary roads, functional. I mean, when you look at projects, I mean, I know we're not running money through the formula, but when you look at the various projects and the amount of money and how we've maintained these roads,
yeah.
I mean, we haven't treated them like they're a secondary road.
They
we've created them something between.
Do we need to say that?
There are projects that were a good example. I mean, you had the Metropolitan Fund that was separate totally. There are just a number of things that have favored the higher use roads. The only concern I have is just to be sure that we keep a semblance of fairness, that you don't go off of a primary paved road onto a dirt road that doesn't have a bridge.
Right. Mr. Chairman, just one last thing. I think if it acts like a, you know, if it acts like a duck and quacks like a duck, let's call it a duck. I mean, if it's a primary road, it's a primary road. I don't have an issue with reclassing a road to what it truly is. That's not my point here. So I'm going to favor this when it happens. But I do question, and obviously you came back with the answer, which I sort of suspected, which is by code. We can't change the code. We can only recommend that we change the code. But it just doesn't make any sense to me to allocate money based on how many roads you already have, to allocate construction money based on how many roads you already have. That makes no sense to me. So, you know, perhaps it's something we can individually talk to our legislators about if we believe in that, but it seems our hands are tied or bound as it relates to how the money flows, but if it's a primary road, we ought to call it a primary road and try to work on the other at a different time.
So, ghost, the bird machine is still out there. Thank you very much. So we'll have this back up next month for these items. Excellent. Okay, we're finished, Sharon.
Good
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, what we wanted to do this month is give you a quick update on the FY 2013 revenue sharing program. As you'll recall, we had a number of legislative changes pertaining to this program in the last General Assembly session, the biggest of which was to increase the maximum allocation up to $200 million. And the prior maximum before last year was $50 million, and increase the amount that an individual locality can request up from $1 million to $10 million. The changes last session also eliminated the priority tiers. Now there's just one basic priority written into the code, and that's to accelerate projects that are either in the six-year improvement program or in a locality's capital plan. And this board adopted a policy and the guidelines on how those funds would be distributed and administered in light of the new legislation in April of last year. In terms of our FY13 formal application process, with the increase of the program up to $200 million, we needed to move up our application timeline so that we would have time to budget for the amount of money that was requested or attempt to budget for that. So we did our call for applications in August with a deadline of November 1st. As has been the history of this program, it's very popular. We got applications from 55 localities. Six of those localities requested the maximum allocation of $10 million. That would include Stafford, Fairfax, Prince William, and Chesterfield counties, and the cities of Suffolk and Virginia Beach. Our total requests were just a little over $132 million, and in your policy guidance that was adopted by the board last April, you've set some internal priorities to separate out those localities that request up to $1 million as the first priority and those that request over $1 million as a second priority, so you see that broken down. As you might recall, the change in the maximum level of funding of the program last year left us a little bit behind in terms of the budgeting process, but we wanted to try to accommodate as many of the applications as we did receive for FY12 as we could. So we actually programmed a little over $53 million of FY13 revenue sharing money to fully fund the FY12, or not fully fund, or fund more of the FY12 program. So when you add all that up, the total required to fund everybody's request for FY13 and the $53 million that we programmed into last year's program is $185.6 million. To show you how that breaks down across the nine districts, the slide on the screen will show you the number of localities per district and also that breakdown between the board's two priority tiers of up to $1 million and then over $1 million requested. This is a slide that we like to use because the revenue sharing program is really a very geographically diverse program. If you look, the localities that apply are pretty evenly distributed across the state. And if you look in terms of the numbers of applications received, they were pretty evenly split between counties and cities and towns in the urban system. 28 were from urban localities, cities and towns, and 27 were from counties. So again, the program stays very geographically diverse, and localities are very eager to find out what the program is going to be funded at in 2013. Shifting gears just a little bit, I wanted to talk briefly about the revenue sharing deallocation. This was a code change in 2008 that established a timeline for the expenditure of revenue sharing funds. The deallocation process that we would use to implement that was adopted as part of the revenue sharing guidelines in April of last year by the Commonwealth Transportation Board. The criteria that we used to look at projects for deallocation was any projects that had not been initiated after two subsequent fiscal years of allocation, and any projects that had been completed that had allocations remaining and hadn't had any activity for 2 years. In December of 2010, we initiated our first review of the revenue sharing program under this code section. We looked at over 2,000 revenue sharing projects. And the initial review based on that criteria indicated that there were 539 projects statewide that potentially met that criteria for deallocation. In June of last year, we provided preliminary lists to each district for them to review with the localities that were potentially impacted by deallocation and to work with those localities on an action plan for any residual funds or whether or not those funds should be deallocated. In October A list of projects was proposed for deallocation was sent to each impacted locality. You also received copies of those letters and those lists. And between October and as recently as last week, we continued to work with localities that had potential impacts from deallocation to see if there were other projects that had deficits or had another place that those funds could be used within the guidelines that were established by the board.
While she's on that point, Dennis, was it possible for local jurisdictions to request the transfer of these funds? I heard part of what you said there. To request transfer of these funds into currently active projects that needed more money?
Right. The priority was if a locality had a project that had a deficit, that those funds could be transferred to that project with a deficit.
But not to a project that they had that they were requesting additional dollars for?
No, not separately, no. The intent was to try to utilize the old money, free up the money that was available for reallocation, and then have new applications put in for new projects.
I guess the question I was asking is whether it could be reallocated within the current jurisdiction as opposed to put back into the statewide pool to be reallocated.
If they could use it immediately, and we've got an example on today's agenda where the locality had a project that could go to advertisement in this fiscal year, we let them make that transfer.
Okay,
and we
great.
Brought those to the board. But if it was something that could not be used immediately or did not fund a deficit, then those were proposed for deallocation because the localities could then come back and reapply for money in the next fiscal year. So today, at today's action meeting, we actually have this proposed four-year action. There were 209 projects representing a little over $17 million in state allocations that we're proposing to have those funds deallocated from. The majority of the projects where we're proposing deallocation are projects that have been completed, and there are residual funds left on those projects. Prior to this deallocation process, projects that are completed that had residual funds, those funds stayed there, the state portion and the local portion, until the locality requested that those funds be removed and the local portion returned to them. So this is actually a process of cleaning up our books, making sure that all of the resources that we have are being adequately utilized to their highest and best use.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
I had a request from one jurisdiction that I had not yet got an answer for about transferring it to in Frederick County.
Okay.
And I would hate to vote to deallocate that money today until I know for sure that particular request was taken care of. Is there anyone that can help me with that?
We can look at that for you during the break of lunch.
All right, thank you.
So the intent of taking the deallocation to the board today is to release the deallocated funds to help fully fund the request that we have for FY 2013 revenue sharing, and that would release $17 million. With that?
Sure.
Councilor
Lane.
That's right.
Yes, Slane.
back to Dr. Davis's comment, the look at this of the $17 million Hampton Roads is about $5 million. And I've had a chance to review most of them were localities, just not me. And so from my perspective, I think it's that's the deal. If you're not going to use it, you're going to lose it in that regard. But it wasn't the opportunity, as you say, had something going. These were simply projects that no activity was happening on. So this would, today we're a donor to the rest of the state. So,
Jennifer, slide 4, where it talks about the various districts and the requests, you have the up to $1 million and over $1 million requested. My math is not working in that. Fredericksburg, you got one. Northern Virginia, you got two. Shouldn't those be in at least $10 million increments? If you got two communities that are each requesting a max 10, that should be 20 or more.
You have to add the two columns together to get the total request. So for those, like for Stafford County, where they requested $10 million, the first million shows up in that category of up to $1 million requested.
Same thing in Nova. Okay.
And the same thing in Nova. Again, that is if depending on how the board chooses to budget and allocate funds for revenue sharing, your first priority is to fund requests up to $1 million.
If that's the case, and let's use Fredericksburg District, there's four localities. You're telling me that one of them's $10 million, which I'm aware of. That means the other three are only requesting $1.5 million at most.
Yes.
Was there any indication on some of the feedback? I mean, not granted, there's some rural communities without a lot of resources, but there's some others that have resources.
I think it's a challenging budget year for local government. You know this, serving on a board of supervisors yourself. What we are hearing back from localities is they love the opportunity to apply for up to $10 million, but it's a budget struggle to prioritize how much they can request in any given year.
Interesting. I mean, I think this is a really good program and a way to get, you know, kind of local skin in the game. Because I'm a little disappointed it's not, there's not a higher application to it, although from our standpoint, I guess 180, whatever the number is we got to come up with is pretty tall climb. But
new applications for $132 million when you're talking about a program that was only $50 million last year is pretty.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, the 132 buys how much in projects?
Double it.
264.
No, but I thought some of them actually are more.
Yeah.
We don't have the overmatch anymore, so you typically see them asking for as much as they can to fund. Some of the projects, like in Hampton Roads, the City of Virginia Beach is using their $10 million to help supplement two other projects.
Mm-hmm.
So we can get you that total.
But yeah, I'm just saying, so 132 might actually be getting us $300 million worth of projects. If not more.
Great program.
Great.
It is. Yes, Mr. Richard.
It appears that the bottom line is that you've gone out of your way to brief these localities so that everybody is fully aware and it was fully apprised and they had an opportunity to try to get more money. And they just didn't come through, so now is the time to deallocate. But everybody has had due notice.
Yeah.
Correct. Okay.
We were making changes at the request of local government as recently as the end of last week.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Appreciate that.
Any other questions? Okay. Actually, we're going to go through. We'll do the finish out the workshop, and then we'll break for lunch, and then we'll get into the main meeting. Mm-hmm. So we now have the Dominion Boulevard, and Mayor Krasnoff's here, and also Mr. Harrell, as well as Mr. Sorry. Gentlemen, come on down. No, I'm sorry, could you state your name? I have never met you before.
Mr. Secretary, God bless you. I want to, first of all, my name for the record is Alan Krasnoff from the city of Chesapeake. I have the opportunity to be in front of you today for a very important item, and we thank you for the opportunity to be here. I want to express my appreciation to you, sir, Secretary Connaughton, and the board for the opportunity to talk about Chesapeake's Dominion Boulevard Bridge project and the importance of the Virginia Transportation Infrastructure Bank to its completion. City Manager William Harrell and Mr. Earl Sorry, our Chief City Engineer, join me today to provide answers to any questions you may have regarding the details of the project. I, however, am merely an elected official, so I'll take a broad brush approach. For decades, the Dominion Boulevard corridor was a sleepy and little-used two-lane road spanning the Intercoastal Waterway. In 1990, the traffic count for the road was just 18,000 vehicles. Today, Dominion Boulevard, still a two-lane road, still with the same lift bridge, is one of the busiest and the most congested corridors in Chesapeake. In 2012, the traffic count has hit 33,000 vehicles per day. As for disruptions to roadway traffic, and because the clearance between the roadway and the water is relatively limited, the lift bridge is open over 6,000 times a year. With an average opening duration of 10 minutes, that means the bridge has been closed to traffic for an equivalent of 42 days a year. And I feel like I've been there every day it's been closed. In 1997, when Chesapeake and the Virginia Department of Transportation began a feasibility study to improve Dominion Boulevard, the estimated project cost was $101 million. Today, the project cost has risen to over $400 million. Today, Dominion Boulevard is one of the most heavily traveled two-lane roads in Virginia. Following a study by the Hampton Roads Transportation Planning Organization prioritizing projects, Dominion Boulevard ranks second overall but first among 153 other projects in terms of its ability to reduce congestion and safety benefits. Dominion Boulevard is also a major transportation link in the Norfolk-Raleigh corridor and a key northbound component for hurricane evacuation plans for those living in the Outer Banks and parts of northeastern North Carolina. In short, as it exists today, Dominion Boulevard corridor has become a choke point in terms of commerce and in safety, especially for the tens of thousands of those who live and work nearby and who use it many times on a daily basis. Dominion Boulevard and the bridge has come to dominate daily life, and not in a positive way. These figures, usage, cost, and rank need bring me here today seeking your assistance. But I want to assure you that we have been active in our efforts to seek financial support from a wide range of sources. Yet despite our best efforts, there is no doubt in my mind that we will not be able to complete this project without your support and a substantial loan from the Virginia Transportation Infrastructure Bank. Chesapeake is the first loan application to have reached this stage, and I'm acutely aware that every I must be properly dotted and every T correctly crossed. For Chesapeake's part, we believe it has, and that this project and this application have reached maturity. The decision is now yours. We hope it will be favorable. I thank you for your courtesy, and I thank you for your understanding of our need. And if you would allow me, I would ask Mr. Harrell to please come forward, our city manager, to address you at this time. Mr. Connaughton, God bless you.
Mr. Mayor, thank you very much. Thanks for being here. Mr. Harrell.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the board. The city of Chesapeake brings 30 years of tolling experience to the table, and we're very proud of that history. We successfully operated the Chesapeake Expressway, including a recent rate increase, and we've certainly gotten very favorable remarks from the rating agencies in terms of the financial performance of the expressway as well as the city of Chesapeake. We have clearly positioned ourselves this day by strategically making Dominion Boulevard our number one traffic priority. We've canceled other projects, and we've consolidated funds in order to advance this very important project. With your help, by advancing Dominion Boulevard project to construction, you will address a decades-old safety hazard for both motorists and maritime travelers. Secondly, you will certainly create a conduit for commerce through the mighty ports of Virginia. As you know, Dominion Boulevard connects the Commonwealth of Virginia with northeastern North Carolina via the Raleigh to Norfolk corridor. We have today several members of city staff that are here, our city attorney. We also have Sean Eckert with BB&T Capital Markets, the city's financial advisor, who's worked very closely with Mr. Lawson and VRA in pulling together a very strong financial package for your approval. We certainly, as the mayor has indicated, certainly want to thank Secretary Connaughton for his guidance and assisting us in improving the overall financing package, which really will address something that's always important to all of us, toll affordability, and certainly Mr. Worley for his help. At this time, I'll call upon Mr. Sori, who will very briefly walk you through the update on the project and status. We recognize we're standing between you and lunch, so we'll move very quickly. Mr. Sori.
The hurricane didn't put it out. Mm-hmm. No, it's fine. I think they just burned out of material. I have met with these people every day.
Mr. Chairman and members of the board, it's an honor to be here today to brief you on the Dominion Boulevard project. It's always a challenge as a city engineer to have to follow my mayor and manager, but I will certainly do my best. The manager mentioned the connection to the interstate system. The map that you see on the screen to your left shows the regional network of interstates in the Hampton Roads area. As you can see, at least portions of Interstate 64, 264, 464, and 664 all pass through the city of Chesapeake. It is U.S. 17 and Dominion Boulevard that connects that network of interstates to northeastern North Carolina and points south. To the map, in the map to your right, you see the corridor. The southern section of the corridor, shown in blue, was improved to four lanes by the state as a VDOT project and completed in 2005. The northern portion of the project, shown in green, is what we refer to as the Dominion Boulevard project. I've already noted that this has and continues to be Chesapeake's top transportation priority. I would like to note that the project is significant not only from a local and statewide perspective, but it's also federally significant. It was designated by Congress as part of the ICE-T legislation as one of 20 NHS high priority corridors and as part of the Norfolk to Raleigh connector. I'd also like to note that it is a state primary route, but the project is being managed locally under contract with VDOT. The biggest impediment to travel along the entire corridor is, in fact, the existing low-level two-lane drawbridge that, as was noted, opens over 6,000 times per year. That, coupled with the high volume of traffic, results in daily gridlock along the corridor. Also has resulted in a very high crash rate for the region. And this corridor does serve as a truck gateway into Hampton Roads, with many of those trucks bound for our local ports. And while we love the trucks, it does present some serious safety concerns for us. You can see some graphics of the existing conditions. The picture to your left is common scene during any opening of the bridge. You can see how the roadway approaches drop off, and that does make the roadway prone to flooding. We do, in fact, end up closing Dominion Boulevard during periods of time during heavy storm events. You can also see from the accident picture, on a two-lane roadway like this, there's just little room for error. And with the low-level height of the bridge opens for all commercial traffic and the majority of recreational vessels as well. The project will improve access to the ports of Hampton Roads. It will certainly directly enhance traffic safety. But it will also improve emergency response times for our own emergency personnel. It will enhance maritime traffic safety, as well as waterway traffic will no longer have to wait for the bridge to open. Also, notably, is the economic development potential, including the potential creation of 13,000-plus non-construction-related jobs based on the amount of developable land south of the southern branch of the Elizabeth River. You can see from the graphic the centerpiece of the project is the twin bridges. Those bridges are over 6,000 feet long, 95 feet high. The project also includes roadway widening, the construction of interchanges at major access points. I apologize for all the numbers on the capital cost, but I'll simply direct your attention to the lower right corner of the screen and the total project cost of $411 million. I will note that engineering and right-of-way phases are funded, so we're requesting today funding assistance for the construction phase. In terms of project status and schedule, the design plans are essentially completed with final approval from VDOT anticipated early next month. The right-of-way acquisition is approximately 50% completed, and notably, all residential relocations have been completed. We do have all of the necessary permits on hand, with the exception of the U.S. Coast Guard permit. We are in regular contact with the Coast Guard 5th District and anticipate issuance of that permit in the March-April timeframe. All of that leading up to a construction advertisement in July, with project completion in mid-2016. We have developed a plan of finance in which the project will be financed with revenue bonds payable from tolls collected from the transportation, from the Chesapeake Transportation System. That system consists of this project, Dominion Boulevard, as well as the existing Chesapeake Expressway. Based on our investment grade traffic and revenue study, the projected revenues do not provide sufficient debt service coverage to achieve an investment grade credit rating for the full amount of the debt necessary to bring this project forward. We have sought funding through a number of avenues, and notably through the Tiger and TIFIA program. We have not been successful in those endeavors, but we have secured roughly $85 million, primarily through the Regional Surface Transportation Program, and that has been factored into our plan of finance. So in closing, we are requesting financial assistance from the VTIB in the amount requested in our December 2nd application in order to advance this project. And Mr. Secretary, that concludes our formal remarks.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Mrs. Lane.
Just a comment. Thank the city officials for being here and going through the merits of the project. I would add, I think my fellow members from Hampton, you know, them in Hampton Roads, Mr. Miller and Mr. Hollis, no one could be more enthusiastic about this project and making sure that it's shepherded through. So I'm very comfortable in terms of its execution, that the focus from the city and the officials will make this a success. And so I just thought I'd let my they could not overstate how enthusiastic they are.
Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry, Mr. Ellis, I think was...
Yeah, I just wanted to make a note. Yes, this is just to reemphasize, and you know, for Mr. Lane's comments, that this is an extremely important project for the city. You know, it's going to be, you know, many economic benefits, you know, and open up more opportunities that could be available that are not available, you know, at this point in time. So, you know, we would hope that the board would have full support, you know, of the project.
Thank you, Mr. Hill. Mr. Miller, then Mr. Garcia.
Mr. Chairman, I was one of those people that used to drive this road fairly extensively when it was a sleepy little road, and I don't drive it much anymore for exactly the reason that you're talking about. I would just tell you that the pictures on existing conditions don't do it justice. It's a little metal bridge over a intercoastal waterway. It's two lanes. There's ditches on both sides. And this thing is, you talk about the roads we just took, or we're talking about taking to the primary system. This road is just ridiculous. It's the number two project in the TPO's list. So, you know, for me, it's one of those ones that just screams for help. So I'm certainly supportive.
Ms. Korzynski?
I think Mr. Miller grew that beard waiting for the bridge to... my question is more one of process, and at the risk of being redundant, I just want to make sure I'm clear on how the CTB fits into the process of what we hope is the first of many applications. Because I thought there was a three-member committee who basically reviewed and approved.
That's what Mr. Tyre is going to...
Oh, okay.
He's going to give his presentation recommendation. And then the way the process will work...
I can wait. That's okay. Fine.
Ms. Tyre, why don't you go ahead and start.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, and ladies and gentlemen of the CTB. I'll walk you through this. As I was listening to the conversation, I wasn't sure that I needed to make this presentation. I thought you were going to go ahead and approve it, but we'll proceed. This is a brief description of the financing that I will ask you to approve in the form of a resolution. The city has requested $151.8 million, and they had requested a subsidized interest rate. We'll tell you later that we actually counter-offered on that. You can see the total cost of the project. It is in the six-year program. The important thing, and there's four or five important things to take away from this presentation. One is that senior lien toll revenue bonds. That means they have to be investment grade, and I will talk to you a little bit about that as we go through a few other slides. City's requested the loan. You've heard the staff from the city talk about that, and we would close on this later this year. And the funding, the money that we would allocate or loan to the project would be spent in 2015 and 2016. It does meet the bank's mandatory criteria. There is a committee. Actually, there are two. There was a group of folks from VDOT and Virginia Resources Authority. We Virginia Resources Authority, you will recall from our enabling legislation, is our management arm of this process. They met and they escort it, and then they move it forward to an advisory committee that is chaired by me. And you can see that process unfolding on this page. Yes, the city is an eligible borrower. The project, as you have heard many of the members in this room say, is a very high priority to the region. It is the city's number one project. Possible 37 points. This project scored 30.
It's not good.
Could not be undertaken without BTIB assistance. The loan that we will provide in order to keep the senior loan at investment grade is about 30% of the project. And I won't talk about the last bullet. You've heard folks in the room talk about that. This is a very important slide, as is the next one. You see the senior toll revenue bonds, both as a regular amortization and a capital appreciation bond at $227.8 million. The VTIB loan is roughly $152 million, and you see the other resources there. The senior bond proceeds are significant, because that is the maximum amount that we could issue and keep it at investment grade. You kind of calculate that based on the tolling and revenue estimate, and then the other items there are identified to fill in the funding. I'm sure some of you will ask, well, what if that senior revenue bond or senior bonds were higher than the toll and revenue estimate, or the traffic and revenue estimate that I will talk to you about on the next page would not be sufficient to cover the debt service, and then that would jeopardize the credit rating. Again, keeping those senior bonds at investment grade is significant to the project. And then you can see the uses on the bottom of the page. On this slide, you see the revenue stream. Again, Chesapeake Expressway and Dominion Boulevard are being combined into a single revenue stream that will service debt on the existing expressway and the new Dominion Boulevard, the monthly O&M, and then the revenue that is available after that. The fourth box down on the chart is the important one, and that is the amount of revenue that is available after O&M to service the debt. And that is significant, again, in terms of investment grade and the amount of revenue that is available, what they call coverage ratio, to actually cover the debt service on the bonds. And then you can see the rest of the cash waterfall, as we call it, unfolding in the other boxes on the flow chart. And you can see as we move through the senior lien reserve, operating reserve, and then the interest and principal on the VTIB loan, about two-thirds of the way down the cash waterfall. We do recommend approval of this loan request. It does meet the objectives of VTIB funding. VTIB is intended to supplement investment grade borrowing to manage projects or to provide credit enhancement, and certainly this loan meets those criteria. A loan up to $152 million. 35 years after substantial completion, it would be repaid as cash waterfall and repaid. All other debt, with the exception of the senior loan, on this project would be repaid within 35 years. That means the expressway loans would be repaid, and this would be repaid. They requested a rate of 3%. We went back to them and said, your revenue estimates would actually allow us to charge a 3.3%, which is the benchmark interest rate in the VTIB guidelines, so there's no need to discount the interest rate. And then if you approve the loan and the resolution after lunch, will enable us to move forward and finalize the terms. As we move forward, the next steps, there isn't anything here that hasn't been talked about otherwise. Up until now, the important thing here is to reiterate that this is an investment-grade senior debt, senior bonds that we need to make this project work. The engineer's report will be coming forward. We'll need to come up with a master trust agreement for this project. And again, this single revenue stream of the expressway and the boulevard will service all debt associated with both projects. You can see the future milestones there. The important one here as a takeaway is that there will be a revised traffic and revenue study in April 2012. It could change the interest rate because it could change the risk of the senior loan, so the interest rate could go lower. And it could actually provide more revenue and enable the city at a lower interest rate to potentially borrow more money, which means we may not even have to go to the entire $152 million that I will ask you to commit to later. And then everything else just reiterates what's already been said by the city staff. Get a rating in the middle of the summer, sell the bonds, close, start construction, and open the facility in 2016. And that's all I have, Mr. Chairman. Are there any questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Billy.
I don't mean to be negative in this question, but be sure I understand correctly. This loan would be secured by Junior Lien, subordinated to $227 million on senior.
That's correct.
Does the statute require any form of security? Specify any particular priority of liens?
Well, the way that the financing structure is envisioned at this point is the senior bonds, the ones that would be sold in the municipal financing marketplace, would be the first call against available revenues, and then those reserves that are shown on the slide, and then the VTIB loan would be in a secondary position, a subordinate position. So that's the way it's designed. That's the way the VTIP guidelines were written. We provide credit enhancements or for interest or other loans to projects to help make them go.
Thank you.
Mr. Lane?
Along those lines, you mentioned the sensitivity of investment grade. Can you define for me what that is? I know it's, you got AAA, but, I mean, what is the sensitivity that they can move down that rating and still be successful getting it financed?
Triple B, we are anticipating Baa1 for this one, I believe. Okay. Baa1 for this one.
Okay. So they got some room.
Yeah, they're getting pretty, in the grand scheme of things, from AAA all the way to Triple B minus, they're getting closer to the bottom of that spectrum than they are at the top of that spectrum.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman,
Secretary, what is the cash flow model here? When does the loan money go into the project? After the senior notes are sold, and that's what triggers then the loan, or what's the timing of the finances here?
These monies would be spent in 2015 and 2016, our monies, but I will let the folks from the city speak about the overall finance.
Good afternoon. I'm Sean Eckert with BB&T Capital Markets. We advise the city regarding this project. In order to issue the senior bonds, there has to be committed funding for the full amount of the project cost. So the step that's being requested today and the detailed agreement that would follow is important to the ability to be able to issue that debt this summer. The expectation is that the proceeds of the senior bonds, that $227 million, will be the first monies spent on construction, and then once those funds have been exhausted, the project will begin to spend down the $151.8 million that is from the infrastructure bank.
So, Mr. Chairman, if I might, so that would mean the actual loan proceeds that come back are sometime 10 years in the future? Or do they begin to come back sooner than that?
The proceeds of the VTIB loan?
Yeah.
They would be repaid over the course of 35 years, starting sometime after. From the time we make the loan until we are totally repaid would be 35 years, beginning some point after a substantial completion of the project, which works.
2016.
Yeah, so we're not anticipating a large return to the loan fund from this type of loan. In other words, we're not actually replenishing the loan cash for the next set of customers, except over a long period of time.
That's correct.
Okay. And then my question, what do we have? $300 million in the...
We have 283, as Charlie said in his presentation earlier today, and then another 67 coming from the FY11 year-end surplus of $350 million available, and this allocates $150 million,
a little less than half. So.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Just two process questions. Were there any other projects in the pipeline? How was this? Was this compared to another project, or how was this done? Was this just the first one that came up?
I will let Mr. Lawson speak to you. We had an open window after the guidelines were approved. We had an open window where we received all applications. There is this one, and there is another one in the pipeline. If all goes according to plan, we would be back here next month asking for your action on another loan. But we would still have considerable portion of that $150 million available even after that action. Of the $350 million available even after next month's action.
Yeah, just to add, we received this application in December and began working on it in order to bring it to the board for this meeting. We received a second application related to a project in Loudoun County. We received that for the first of the year, and we are going through that application now and with plans to bring that to you next month.
So only two have really applied under this.
We've only received two applications to date.
I appreciate that information. This is another kind of process question. In the unlikely event that the revenues don't support the payment back of the bonds, what happens then? If the revenues aren't sufficient to sustain the project, what happens in that case?
That's what happens.
Pretty.
You're saying if the revenues are not sufficient to repay the loan at the end of 35 years?
Expected. And what happens? Will they come back to the bank and ask for more? Or what happens to the project if we're off on the revenue projections from the tolls? In other words, if the tolls don't sustain the capitalization, if I'm saying that right.
I understand the question. We have been very conservative to this point. As I said, we will get another traffic and revenue update. And there is a toll advisory committee that the city has set. So there is a range of tolls that could be set in terms of funding this position. Funding this project, or as this borrowing occurs. But you could raise the rate. You could raise the toll. But then you would have traffic diversion. So the object, as you've heard from everyone, is to make this a better transportation corridor. So there's, as the toll advisory committee in the city considers setting the tolls, they'll have to be very conscious of that. Right now, we think the revenue has been set conservatively. We think when the revenue estimate comes out in another few months, the revised one, that the revenues will be a little bit better.
But what happens if you don't make, we don't make the money?
They are obligated to pay at least the interest, and then the principal, they may not make all of the principal repayments. What we're doing in this illustration here in the fourth box down is what we call a cash sweep. So if we go through those first three boxes, and then 60% of the available cash at that point repays the transportation infrastructure bank loan, but they have to pay minimally the interest.
But I guess theoretically there could be a bankruptcy under these types of situations.
I think
I would say probably not a bankruptcy, probably a renegotiation.
Yeah, I think the most logical what would happen is the loan would get extended.
Right.
Because this is not a grocery store going out of business, it's a traffic.
Right.
It's a matter of getting, so it, to answer that, I think the most logical downside is the loan would get extended over periods of time. We wouldn't get it paid back.
Just Mr. Lawson, if you want, Mr. Harrell, I don't know if you want.
I just wanted to add that they're asking for a 35-year loan, but their plan of finance has it repaid in 27 years.
Right.
So they do have a window there that it, within that approved loan that they have in case things don't materialize.
Mr. Harrell?
I would just add, from the city's perspective, you know, as we would with any other financing matter, and I'm sure it will be part of our bond covenants, we would evaluate through an appropriate rate structure. And the fact that we're not just talking about a new facility with Dominion Boulevard, but the 30-year history we have with the Chesapeake Expressway, which has been favorably rated. So we have the ability, I think, to make adjustments in order to meet our financial obligations. The city, over the course of the last 3 to 4 years, has increased its bond ratings, being rated triple A by Fitch. So in terms of fiscal matters, we certainly wouldn't let a facility of this importance default.
Yeah, I just thought I needed to ask that on behalf of the taxpayers. You know, we had the city of Birmingham, Alabama, about ready to go bankrupt because of a sewer project, and these things come up, you know.
Yeah, we're not talking about a sewer project. Just to give you a parallel to the federal TIFIA, to the federal TIFIA system or federal TIFIA loan program, has never had one go into default. They've only had one in their history that went into restructuring. So we've been very conservative in setting the guidelines for the VTIB program, tried to model the federal TIFIA program to the extent it was applicable. And as I said, there is flexibility both within the terms and within the rate structure here, so I think it should be fine.
Appreciate your
think about it from this perspective. I mean, what we're doing is assisting this project to move forward. In the alternative, we'll be waiting around until we had more money to help them make this project, and where it would have been a grant, then we wouldn't have had any quote unquote skin in the game. So this is in many ways a good, I'm going to say, foundation loan for us then to start to generate long-term revenues that can then go back into other projects. Because as soon as you start getting these revenue streams from several projects, hopefully, then that will provide us with, it's not just simply the loan, it's those revenue streams which then will enable us to go out with even more loans.
Borrow, yeah. Leverage that.
Mr. Korsinski.
Mr. Secretary, is it the responsibility of the CTB to track that as it moves along, as this program gets more sophisticated with more applicants? Or are we is this basically the process that David or John will bring a project forward, will know that it's been reviewed, we'll see all the details, and we pass on it. But from that point on, tracking it, tracking how much money we have in the fund and whether the cash flows are working or not is the responsibility of
position, okay, as the Deputy Secretary and the Chair of the Advisory Committee, the statute says that we have to give an annual report on this.
I just wanted to be clear on that.
Yeah, so we're essentially, way I look at this is we're sort of the loan committee. And applications come in, staff's reviewed, made recommendations based on the criteria that we adopted and working with DRA. We essentially say yay or nay, and then they take it from there and follow it forward. Hey, Stephanie, where's Stephanie Shebeck? Could you come up? Come on back here. Come on up here. Who's with us is Stephanie Hammett, who is the head of the Virginia Resources Authority. And Stephanie, can you just tell us, I mean, how does this fit into how you do some of your other programs? And
we've handled this as we handle most of our other programs from the standpoint of, and the credit does not go to me, it goes to two other gentlemen hiding in the back. We do an extensive credit analysis of the projects, looking at the projections that have been given to us, and we work with Sean Eckert and with the city on reviewing those. It's probably a 40 or 50 page, you know, analysis of the credit. Now, in our other programs, we are actually making the loan. For example, we have a pool program. We go to the market. It's AA, AAA credit, and we would look at that to be a investment grade and whether it would sell in that sort of market. But we sit as a credit committee, we look at that analysis and determine. And in this instance, we do the same thing. We go through the same very long process in looking at the credit and then come back and work with the committees and with the folks at transportation to describe the credit and how we see it. And we recognize that this is a little different than our pool program. role. We explain the credit, what its risks are, what its benefits are, but we do look to transportation as to the importance of the project and from a transportation standpoint. And, you know, in this instance, we recognize that it is doable, and we think that you will get paid back over time, although the risk is it could be extended if the projections don't come out the way that you think. But also for you guys, knowing that, to determine that the project is worth that risk given where it fits into the transportation program. So I hope that's somewhat helpful.
Stephanie, I'm sorry, could you just, when you, so you're really the one, I mean, by law, our manager on this, and you'll actually work out all the details on the actual loan terms and, you know.
Yes, and the tracking of it and the things of that nature that you asked about. Well, I think of, in a sense, as we are like fiscal analysts and credit analyst staff to the VTIP.
Mr. Chairman, and kind of in follow-up to what Gary's saying, I think it would be helpful as we're getting into this and more projects come online, that we could get some feedback as to how they're progressing. In other words, what the original estimates were, how they're going along as far as revenue collections, that type of thing, how they're paying off the debt. It doesn't have to be elaborate, in my opinion, but just something to kind of give us an idea of how these things are moving. So we kind of, from a board perspective, even can have a lessons learned as the projects move. So that would, to me, would be helpful.
Absolutely.
Any other questions? Stephanie or for Dave? Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. We appreciate it. All right, what we're going to do is we're going to take a 20-minute break. 20 minutes, all right? We'll start up at 1:15, then we'll go right into the regular meeting. I appreciate very much the presentations, and we will go break for lunch.